big-time card coming up this weekend in the main event. Kaikara France taking on Amir Albazi. Co-main all-action Alex Caceres taking on the Pit Daniel Pineda. A big-time card of action. And it's coming at you this weekend. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. And just like that, we're back, and I'm as red as Chuck Falcon's bodyguard, the Goon. If you watch the league, you get that one. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen.
Two pale men are looking awfully pink today.
At Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, when we do look at this card, I mean, coming up, we do have the 74th iteration of an Apex card. And the first one was way back when Gilbert Burns fought Tyron Woodley. But you look at it overall and in general, Kaikara France taking on Amir Albazi, the first non-title flyweight main event since Sergio Pettis took on Brandon Moreno way back in Mexico City in 2017. But overall, I mean, there's only two ranked fighters that you have in that main event. You also have Caceres and then Tim Elliott ranked on this one. So four ranked fighters in general. But when you look at it top to bottom, a lot of recognizable names.
We've got some name value on this card for sure.
Elize Uzuleski de Santos is going to be taking on Abubakar Nurmagomedov. You also have Guram Khatatladze taking on Jamie Mullerkey. Some debuts on this as well. I mean, Muin Gafurov getting that short notice call up to take on John Castaneda as well. Karine Silva is going to be taking on the recent Invicta flyweight champ. It is Ketlin Souza. But when you do look at it again, overall, a lot of prospects. Some prospects, but they're long in the tooth on experience, so you can't even consider them that much. It is a lot of high-level talent outside of the rankings.
And a lot of really competitive fights on this card, which is what I really like. And like you said, not a lot of ranked fighters, a lot of recognizable names, though, and that's something I wanted to say. Like, we haven't mentioned that Andre Arlovsky is fighting on this card. He's one of the greatest heavyweight fighters of all time. Now, I understand if you haven't been watching MMA for about 25 years. It is easy to forget just how talented this guy once was in his career, but still, anytime those kind of A-list kind of pioneers are fighting, I know I always get excited for it. And the fact that Max Grecian versus Felipe Lynch is the first fight on the card, I know that's not a fight that's going to make people cancel their plans on Saturday night, but I still think that's a fun competitive matchup to open the card up with.
Hey babe, 2005 UFC heavyweight champ, he's on this card. PFL champ in their first season, they're on this card. Cancel the reservations. We're going to be
watching.
You guys
know I get excited for a Jim Miller fight. And that one against Jared Gordon's a really fun matchup.
Well, make sure you let us know down below in the comments section who you have throughout these fights. 13 total as of Sunday night when we tape this. I mean, listen, it's going to be one of those weeks. You know that it's probably going to be in flux. UFC Apex, the site. If anything changes throughout the week, we will be sure to update you. You can always find us Spotify and Apple Podcasts for the audio version. A like is always appreciated here on YouTube. We have 13 total fights to cover. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Originally, this bout was booked for last October, but Felipe Lin, so they say, was not cleared medically to take the fight. So Max Grecian accepts a matchup against Jailton Almeida. He's so hot right now. And ultimately, that fight falls out. So remix it and move it forward. Back not that long ago, Felipe Lin ends up fighting Ovince St. Preux and knocks him out in the first round, in the first minute. So ultimately, what do you get out of knocking out a former title challenger?
Nothing at all, Craig.
The guy you're supposed to fight back in October. So we do end up with this matchup at light heavyweight between the former PFL champ in Felipe Lins and a man who nearly made it to the top of the mountain with the PFL in Max Grecian. His last matchup over there was his second bout against Jordan Johnson and ended up one of those two-round draws. Grecian ends up into the UFC on short notice against Marcin Tybura, up a weight class, and we're off to the races. But when we look at this matchup, Matt, these two guys are so high up on experience. I mean, exactly. For Felipe Lins, he was one of the top Bellator guys not that long ago. Well, it was back in 2014. And at that time, he ended up taking on Kelly Knudsen, a guy, a three-time All-American, Newberry College. If you saw me talking about him, I tweeted about him over the weekend because Kelly, I mean, he was supposed to fight this past weekend, and it was a four-year return. But Kelly Knudsen's one of those guys that it was a leg injury to Felipe Lins. He also has a finish win over Volkan Oezdemir. But you look at Lins, he gets hurt in that fight. He hurts his right knee. He ends up taking a really long time off. He has to kind of build his way back up. And he gets a win here against Guilherme Viana. He ends up losing to Kleber Silva and then Vadim Nemkov. But if you watch Felipe Lin's fights, even back when he was with Bellator, before that as well, into his title run with the PFL where he gets all of those wins at heavyweight and gets the $1 million, when you watch a Lin's fight from way back when to now, when he has the most success, he is throwing the kitchen sink at you in a strike.
That's kind of where I'll jump in, if you don't mind, because we have seen different versions of a guy like Felipe Lins, and people talk about things like octagon jitters, right? And you would think a guy like Lins, who has fought in the PFL, fought in Bellator, been in fairly high-level fights in the past, would have such jitters coming into the UFC, but it did feel like he almost had a lack of confidence, because you're right, when he moves forward, when he is Bangkok ready, moving those hands, Felipe Lins is a handful to deal with.
And now, time out. Is there a lot of technique?
Yeah. Not necessarily, but he does throw big bombs, and he is a huge athlete. And that's the thing about Lins. I'm kind of more surprised out of these two guys that he is making the move down to 205, because Lins is thick, right? Like, Grecian's a tall, muscular guy, but to me, Lins's got that thickness to him, so I think it might be a difficult weight cut to 205.
That's the scary part where I'm going to zig deer zag. Felipe Lins in the UFC, 0-2 at heavyweight. Felipe true. Lins at light heavyweight, 2-0, and he's looked physically great at 205.
That's true.
His first round against Marcin Prakhniau, loses that, but he rallies back round two, round three, and then his last time out against OSP, gets a first round knockout.
We were talking before we started filming, though. I'm personally trying not to kind of make that OSP knockout a big deal in my mind, because I want to look at that. I want to think of, hey, Lins is improving technically, even though he is at 37 years old, because I will say, he's got a pretty dangerous ground game to go along with those big hands that he will throw out there. So I don't think this is a fight where Grecian's going to be willing to go for a lot of those weird trip takedowns that we often see from the clinch, because if we do see Grecian go for some of those takedowns, we do see a lot of clinch between these guys. That's one of those opportunities where Lins could kind of just, you hate to say get lucky, but you know what I mean, right? Just end up in that top position, and that's where Grecian could find himself in a world of hurt, because Lins is a very heavy athlete once he does get on top. But that's the big question mark I have coming into this matchup. A, who's going to shoot for that first takedown? Because whoever gets on top is going to have a lot of success in this fight. We have seen Grecian have a good amount of success with his own takedown attempts and with his power punching, with his entries for his takedown attempts. So I'll be very curious to see who goes for some of those initial wrestling exchanges, because I do think both guys can have success in that area. I just think it really comes down to where do they end up once they do end up on the mat.
And it's awkward for Felipe Lins because his teammate Andre Arlovsky's on this card and they fought each other in the UFC and it was Arlovsky getting the win. And if you look at it for Lins, I mean, his Topology page looks like a 40-something masking as a 30-something. There's a lot of gray if you don't use that hair dye. And that's been the issue for Felipe Lins in the UFC. He just hasn't been able to have steady activity. He's been forced out of bouts, and so have his opponents. And if you look at it for Grecian, kind of the same narrative as well. I mean, Grecian comes in at heavyweight, loses to Marcin Tybura. It's a really weird run because he gets a win over Gachimrad and Tsigulov, which was kind of what everybody was able to do on the way out. He has a loss to Dustin Jacoby, where a lot of folks thought that he won that one, but his last time out against William Knight. So he misses weight when he takes on Jacoby against William Knight. William Knight showed up ready for a heavyweight fight at 218, and you had a guy in Mr. Max Grecian coming in at 206. He gets the win. He looks amazing. 30-27s across the board. But what can I tell you about the styles? Well, I kind of alluded to the fact that Felipe Lins, if he throws his hands and he gets those wide looping power shots involved in with his leg kick, he looks really good. Now, Lins will throw the occasional leg kick. He doesn't check leg kicks. Max Grecian throws one of the best leg kicks at light heavyweight.
Heavy ones.
And he kind of pitter-patters on the outside. And we've seen, and I'll throw it up there on the screen, you watch guys getting beat by Max Grecian leg kicks. I mean, it is all over. His fight against Konchenko, the guy's writhing. People would say writhing in pain after that. But you go through and you look at Max Grecian, some of the wins, some of the losses. He hasn't been finished in years and years. And even if we talk about it, he had an M1 global title fight way, way back against one Kenny Garner back in 2011. He tapped due to strikes in that one as it went on. And the commentary team, which was Pat Miletich and Mauro Ranallo, had no idea what was going on. Didn't think it was going to be over. But you look at the level of competition for both guys. I know it is very high.
Very good.
It's the pitter-patter leg kick out of a guy like Max Grecian, Steady Eddie, and it's a lot of big actions out of a guy like Felipe Lins. And cat out of the bag, when this fight was announced back in October of last year, we both had Maximus Max Grecian in the match.
And I'm having a really hard time with it right now, too. And of course, we don't really talk about the odds at the end of it. They are very close, and there's no reason why they wouldn't be, because both both these guys are in a very similar position. Kind of tweeners, right? Like, you're big for light heavyweight, you're small for heavyweight, you're just trying to do what you can do. And that's why this is such an important fight, because for Linz, he is on a bit of a heater, right? Like, I never thought we were going to say that after his first few fights in the heavyweight division, but he has definitely settled into 205. I'll be curious to see how he counters the leg kicks of Grecian. I'm glad to bring them up, because if Linz is able to get a takedown early, maybe catching Grecian off balance and getting on top, that might cut down all the volume from some of those attacks from a guy like Grecian. And if that does happen, unless Grecian is able to hurt him with a straight shot moving back, which is a pretty difficult thing to do, I could see Linz starting to take over in some of those striking exchanges.
Yeah, Linz is one of those interesting guys. When he feints with the jab and feints the takedown, it opens up a lot of his striking. You've seen that when he was with Bellator, PFL, and in the UFC. And my favorite quotable out of the Linz fights, going back and watching it, when he took on Vadim Nemkov, Mike Goldberg said, and I quote, "Just a little touch to let your partner know you're there. Just a little touch to
sounds
let
like
your
an
partner
80s love song.
Know you're there." Or a softcore nudie vid.
Wow.
But
you
when
went
you
there.
Look at this one, Matt, I mean, the last time these two guys fought, 87% of the fans on Topology had Max Grecian. So I'm going to say this time around, the fans like that OSP knockout, I'm going to say over under 70% Max Grecian.
I think they'll be under, but it'll be the favorite.
And we have a look at Topology. They are close. 1,383 total votes, 59% Grecian, 75% by knockout. For the 41% that have Linz, 53% by knockout, 38% by decision. If Grecian decides that he wants to try and wrestle, which he's implemented some of the earlier rounds in his recent fights, I mean, he is a master of sport and army hand-to-hand combat. You look at Grecian, you could get caught in one of those guillotines like you saw Linz able to do against Vienna, that he was able to do it up against when he was competing with the PFL. So for me, I guess it was Caio Alencar, not Vienna. But when you look at this overall, I mean, I still have Max Grecian in the matchup, but Felipe Linz, he's a live guy out there.
I would say sure. I agree with where the Topology votes are. Like, 59% of myself thinks Max Grecian is going to win, but the 41% could make a pretty compelling argument for Felipe Linz, so I'll stick with the Grecian pick, but it's a very close fight.
A very close fight. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this light heavyweight matchup. Some big fights on this card. Main event, Kai Kara-France taking on Amir Albazi. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
UFC win number one is the priority at a bit of a crossroads fight coming up this weekend at Bantamweight. We have the monster, Damon Blackshear, the former CFFC champ. He's going to be taking on Novo Uniao's own Luan Lacerda. And if we talk about gaining stock in a loss, Luan Lacerda gained all of that stock when he took on Cody Stamann in his UFC debut, and it seemed like an odd bit of matchmaking because Stamann was on a little bit of a heater. Lacerda was able to take advantage of the LFA fights that have been taking place recently in Brazil, but at the same time, that step up in competition was definitely something. But I mean, out of the first round, Lacerda looked amazing with his kicks. He was able to really utilize his length that he has at bantamweight against a much smaller Cody Stamann, and Lacerda got it done in that first round. The second round, it was definitely a Stamann round. And then in the third round, that's where you go, well, Lacerda definitely won it because Stamann was on the back foot. And I know a lot of people, the way that they saw that fight, the first round could have gone either way. I'm painting a Lacerda picture with his kicks. Yeah. But overall, it was a very, very good fight out of Luan Lacerda, a guy who may be kind of talked about in that pantheon of greatness at Novo Uniao, main training partner being Jose Aldo, training with the boys. I mean, you have so many great fighters out of that gym, past and present. Rafael Dos Anjos, one of those guys, is still doing the damn thing. But if you look at it overall, Luan Lacerda has a tattoo below his, right collarbone. And it says, "Black belt in my blood." And boy, oh boy, does this guy have submissions for days. And that's what makes this fight really interesting, because for Damon Blackshear, wrestling is in the back pocket. You saw him have success against his UFC debut, or in his UFC debut, which was a draw. And overall, Blackshear getting it done with CFFC, some of the regional scene in the United States. Overall, out of this fight, though, Matt, I mean, if it's a standing affair, the boxing of Blackshear, the kicks of Lacerda, if it goes to the ground, it could be a smorgasbord of fun.
If you would ask me before Lacerda's last fight how this fight would look on the feet, I would say Blackshear probably wins the majority of those moments, but personally, I was pretty impressed by how Lacerda was able to deal with a guy like Stamann, who does pressure you a lot, and when you're dealing with a pressure wrestler, what do you normally not throw? Kicks, because it makes it easier for them to take you down. But Lacerda was still able to get off really effective kicks, and that's the thing. If you could do it against Cody Stamann, Hearn, who may or may not have lost against Tiny Vitor Belfort's last time out, very close fight, then you should be able to do it against a guy like David Blackshear, who definitely hasn't proven the level of wrestling that a guy like Cody Stamann has, in the UFC at least, because for Stamann, what got him to the dance, into the top 10, into the top 8, top 7 at one point?
He only got to the top 10.
Was it only the top 10? He was a big deal at one point. Shout out the Fire Kid, Tom Dukin won. Never got talked about because I think he left and went to modeling. But for Luan Lacerda, I was very impressed by him in that loss, and I'm glad that you started it that way. That he didn't gain a lot of stock even in that loss, but for Blackshear, I think his body attacks, especially with the boxing, are going to be very important, because if he's able to get close enough to Lacerda, negate kind of the wrestling from both of them, because that's what Blackshear does have at his advantage in this fight. He gets to decide whether they're on the feet or whether they're on the ground, because Lacerda does have takedowns. I would not say they are to the level or with the technique of a guy like Blackshear, who can go for single legs, can mix them in with double legs. He's a lot more dynamic with the way that he will shoot for his grappling exchanges, but like you said, every time Blackshear shoots for a takedown, it's going to put himself in probably the most dangerous position he can put himself in the fight. And that's a spot where Lacerda can not just necessarily grapple per se, but grapple on the in-betweens, because that's where he catches a lot of guys. Oh, we're going for a takedown. This is a bit of a scramble. Well, that's when Lacerda can end up in a good position and really start threatening with a lot of his grappling.
I mean, to really put it into perspective, at the time that Lacerda fought Cody Stamann, in the Topology rankings, Stamann was number 31 and Lacerda was number 146. Wow. So it was a big mismatch, but Lacerda definitely looked good. And if you go back through, Lacerda was able to land some double leg takedowns of his own, which surprised a lot of people. But if you do go down through it, you go back and you rewatch some of the Lacerda fights, you'll see that he does have a Muay Thai stance, but he's kind of like a Diego Lopes is in grappling to the gym that he's out of in Mexico. A lot of strikers at Lobo Gym with, of course, Alexa Grasso and Irene Aldana, who's going to be at UFC 289. The jiu-jitsu coach of Lopes looked great against Evloev. Lacerda's the jiu-jitsu guy at a striking gym in Novo Inao, and he looked really good in that debut against another high-level fighter. So there's high-level fighters all over the world. You never know what you're going to get. With Blackshear, though, again, going even back to his amateur career, a win and a loss against Tony Gravely. He ended up popping onto the FNP radar. I covered the story, but the first fight that was ever covered, or at least the first fight card that was ever covered by the channel at NEF34, home of the Brave, Blackshear won in the main event against one Aaron Lacy. And he's obviously gone on to do great things. The Shooto Brazil champ is Lacerda. The CFFC champ is Blackshear. And if you want to add more names to that, Pat Sabatini is one of his losses. Chris Moutinho, he has a win over Matteo Vogel, the Canadian, who's going to be fighting on Contender Series this summer. So a lot of high-level experience, but with Blackshear, he can always fall back on that wrestling, really likes to get the back, threaten with the rear naked choke, but he can swim through a lot of those bad positions, as can a guy like Lacerda, who you'll see threaten with some leg locks and some tricky spots to then get into some dominant positions. So when you do look at this matchup, Matt, in terms of Lacerda is actually the favorite when we look at the odds, if you look at the Topology votes, surprise to us there to you, I'm going to say that the fans were won over with Lacerda. I'm going to say over under 67.5% for the Brazilian.
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? And it is over. So 1,359 total votes, 75% Lacerda, 70% by decision for the 25% that are Blackshear, 61% by decision. We didn't even talk about Blackshear's last fight against Fred Bacharach.
A really good fighter, guys.
Yeah, Javid's really, really good. Farid has only had the one UFC fight, but when you go back and watch that, Blackshear couldn't get it going in the first, couldn't get it going in the second, in the third, he rallied back and had a good third round. The scary part for me when I look at this fight is, Damon Blackshear, when he was an amateur, when he started off his pro career, is at Team Rock in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where he's from. Then he moved to Jackson Wink, and he had all the success with CFFC. He had the first fight to make his UFC debut. He loses to Fred Bacharach, and what does he do? We just did an interview with James Lynch, and he said, oh, I'm in Florida now. Well, where are you at in Florida? Training at American Combat Gym with Charles Rosa, but mainly at a KO Zone, which is the gym that Omar Morales recently fought out of when he took on Duncan. So when you look at this matchup, Matt, I find the camp change a little bit perplexing. I get it. You want to be a little refreshed training out of a new gym. But for Blackshear, that's a big question mark on that one.
I mean, he's 12-5, though, you know? It'd be a little bit different if he was 19-1, 19-2. But the fact that he's 12-5-1, I just think he's looking to improve his game, to be completely honest with you. Like, I don't see that big of a deal with it. I understand that you might be a little bit concerned about the first camp or so. But personally, I like when people train around. You know, like we saw with with Kamaru Usman, and this is going to kind of bring me into my last point. When you think about how Devon Blackshear fights and how he wrestles a lot more like a Kevin Lee character, right? He's going to take you down, get the back, and look a lot more for those submissions. Whereas Lacerda fought a guy who I would say fights more like a Kamaru Usman his last time. He's going to go for the wrestling and go
when
and try to hold
when has Cody Stamann fought for takedowns?
No. He's fought in takedowns for a lot of his fights. He did that against Sonya Dong. He did that against Marlon Vera. He did that against Tom Duken while way back in the
day. None recently, though.
But no, I just, Cody Stamann in wrestling got him ranked. I understand the thing that got him unranked is the fact that he doesn't wrestle anymore. But Lacerda fought a guy who is going to threaten a lot more with his dominant wrestling. Just my whole point is Blackshear's going to go for the initial wrestling and then entice some of those grappling exchanges. And I think for that reason, I could see Lacerda out scrambling him in some of those moments. So I do find myself leaning Lacerda, but if Blackshear can find himself just being really heavy on top, doing enough ground to pound to just win out on the rounds, I do think he has the wrestling advantage. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was able to spring the upset, but I do have Lacerda in the matchup.
Lacerda scares me a lot if you're going to make him a pick, because while his hands have come up as his career's gone on, his head doesn't move and he tends to chase a lot in his fight, so he's there to be countered throughout the fight from round one to round three, but he is really tricky with that jiu-jitsu, so Blackshear could definitely flow with his boxing. But I do like the kicks out of a guy like Lacerda. I do like the advancements that I've seen in a career progression. So Matt, both of us going with Brazil's Luan Lacerda in the matchup. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big time fights on this card in the co-main event. Alex Caceres taking on the Pit. Daniel Pineda, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Couple of strawweights fighting for their respective roster spots. We have the former atomweight champ from Over with Invicta, it's Jinyu Fry, taking on the former CFFC strawweight champ, Elise Reed. And when you go down through it and you look at both of their respective careers, I mean, taking on some very high levels competition. Oh, yeah. With Elise Reed, the win over Hillary Rose when she's with CFFC, she's already got the belt because she beat Jasmine Jassavizius before that. But in the UFC for Reed, she's hitting at a 2-3 clip. And if you look at it for Jinyu Fry, fights against Hamasaki, Seohi Ham, some really high names. She was that champ, as I had mentioned, with Invicta. But in the UFC, it is at a 2-4 margin. And I mean, yeah, one of her losses was really close, really controversial against one Vanessa Demopoulos. But her last time out, Virginia Fry against Pollyanna Viana, she went out there and got finished, and it was a tricky little shot from Viana. I mean, she was really landing great at distance, but that was a knockout, like a knockout at strawweight, which you don't see all that often. So a tough one for Fry. Obviously, she is coming into this fight just having turned 38 in the last couple of weeks, taking on the much younger Elise Reed. But when you break these two fighters down stylistically, Elise Reed is very much a third degree Taekwondo black belt. She can strike great when she's moving forward, but really good when she's moving backwards, like she did in her fight against Jassavizius or Hillary Rose, or pick any one of her wins. But if you look at it for Reed, I mean, she does struggle against the takedowns, and that's where everybody has gone to. And for Reed, out of all five fights in the UFC, she's been taken down at least once in all of them. We know the fight against Sajara Eubanks at flyweight, that was on really short notice. That one's sort of forgivable. But her last time out against Loma Lukbunmi, it was almost a little lackadaisical in that second round. And I found myself in a Dorval Quebec hotel room, shouting and smiling for a Loma Lukbunmi submission win. Never in my mind did I think that Loma would win by submission against Elise Reed. So if you do look at this matchup overall, Reed's going to throw a wide variety of shots. Jinyu Fry, it's a lot of combinations, a lot of forward movement, and a little bit of body work too. She does like to throw that left hook to the body. But when you look at this matchup, Matt, again, both of them really fighting for their jobs here.
They are, and that's been the big problem with Jinyu Fry during her UFC tenure. Where was she the champion in Invicta? 105. Where did she fight in the UFC? 115. And you can get bigger. We have seen fighters move up in divisions. But for Fry, she's not a big frame by any means.
Neither one of these fighters are. They're both 5'3".
They're both 5'3", but I do... 5'3", sorry. But I do feel like Elise Reed is much more of a strawweight. Like, maybe she could make 105. Maybe, but Virginia Fry, we've seen her have not only success there, but tons of success in that weight class. I just feel like for Fry, look at a lot of her UFC wins. She's getting out-muscled in some of those. Remember the Kay Hansen fight? Like, I don't think Kay Hansen's a more skilled fighter than Virginia Fry is whatsoever, but Jinyu Fry got out-muscled and got out-wrestled in a lot of those exchanges.
Yeah, she had won the first round, won the second round, and then got out-wrestled in the third round and got finished in that one.
Against a fighter who, okay, isn't on the roster. And that's why this fight is so important for both these athletes. And for Reed, I do think her movement can help her evade some of those early takedowns. Now, you bring it up. She has been taken down in every single one of her UFC fights. It just really comes down to how or what level of success can her opponent have after they have taken her down. Because for Reed, she does have great kicks on the outside. She does fight in a bigger frame than she is because, again, her movement is very good. She incorporates a lot of kicks, a lot of very good combinations in her game as well. But if Frey's able to take her down and really get into like a heavy half guard, we have not necessarily seen enough out of an Elise Reed to say, oh, she's going to really be able to fight out of some of those deeper positions if Frey is able to secure that top.
And that's where we saw Reed really struggle against one of Jinyu Frey's teammates and Sam Hughes. Sam Hughes gets on top, and that was the beginning of the end. A TKO win there for Hughes, and for Jinyu Frey training with Emily Ducote, who you saw recently against Lupe Godinez, as well as the aforementioned Sam Hughes. For Frey, yeah, it's been a weird rocky road. I mean, she loses to Loma Lookmanmi, a lot of striking at distance. She goes out there, gets a couple of big wins over Gloria DePaula and Ashley Yoder, loses to Vanessa Demopoulos by split, but most thought that she had won that one. And then her last time, she goes out there and gets finished. And if you look at it for Elise Reed, she is actually 1-0 against southpaws in the UFC and throughout her overall career. The only southpaw she fought was Super Melly Melissa Martinez, and off of a leg kick in the first round, it's a step in right hand, and that drops Martinez, and Reed was able to eke out that decision win after that. So if you do look at this matchup, Reed is the slight favorite here. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you, but I think they're going to be pretty darn close. I'm going to say over under 60% Elise Reed.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. It's over. 1,373 total votes, 71% Reed, 90% by decision. For the 29% that are Frey, you have 83% by decision. So a lot of people thinking strawweight overs. Strawweight overs. What do you think?
To me, it really comes down to how early can Frey get the takedown in a round if she is able to get the takedown? Because let's say she can secure it with, what, 4 minutes left in the round? That's a lot of time that you have to make up for in the next round if you're able to even really get there. But I do find myself ever so slightly favoring Elise Reed in the matchup. I do think she is going to be the more devastating striker on the outside. And if she can hurt Frey with a couple shots as she is making her way in, I think that's going to make Frey a little bit more hesitant to secure those takedown attempts. Now, if Jinyu Frey goes out there and just completely out-grapples her, looks like Khabib Nurmagomedov, I don't mind eating this L, if I'm completely honest, but I do have Elise Reed in the matchup.
Frey's much more of a striker than she is a grappler. And when she does get on top, she can do really good work. She likes to go for the ground and pound. You obviously have seen her out of Genesis BJJ, Frey Martial Arts with her husband Douglas, and Fortis MMA. So Saif Saud is going to be yelling from that corner. But when I look at it, I do like Elise Reed on the back foot. We saw Loma Lookmanmi. She was able to throw a lot of volume out there against Jinyu Frey from the outside. I can see Elise Reed going out there and doing that. I think this is the first time I picked Elise Reed to win a fight in the UFC. So this is different for me and probably not a good sign. But Matt, both of us going with a former CFFC champ at a Kickside Martial Arts in Princeton, New Jersey, Elise Reed to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Some big time matchups on this card, including Andre Arlovsky and Dontale Mays. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Originally to be at UFC 288, 2 days before the clash, out was Willie Cat Daniel Santos, and then they rebooked the fight. So ultimately, we get Santos versus Munoz Jr. to come up this weekend. We talked about this fight at great length. Matt's wearing a Dolphins jersey in the video. You're going to want to check that out. Coming up this weekend, we have Brazil's Daniel Willie Cat Santos taking on Sequence Jiu-Jitsu and Entram Gym's own Kid Kvenbo, Johnny Munoz Jr. And when you look at a fight like this, you can't help but get excited. I know this is a good one to kick off the prelim portion of the card because we focus on the man that's on the left side of the screen that's not me. We're talking Willie Cat here for a second. I mean, the nickname's after a Thundercat character, but what we do know about Daniel Santos is his last time out, 4 days before the fight, it was announced that it was going to be a catchweight contest of 140 pounds. That's why you see it there on the screen. Daniel Santos comes in at 138.5, and nobody really knew why it would be a catchweight, but we knew it was going to be a catchweight nonetheless. In the first round, it's all action. John Castaneda is landing combinations. He's landing those head kicks that are wobbling Daniel Santos. The strikes in the first round, 50-19 for Castaneda. He won that round on all three judges' scorecards. So in the second round, all right, is the weight thing going to come into effect for one of those guys? Well, It seems like Castaneda kind of blew it a little bit early, but to his credit, Daniel Santos, we know him as the King of Spin, but you knew him with that left hook, the uppercut, and then the knee that he was able to land in tight. Castaneda was just kind of hanging around, there to be hit. His hands completely dropped. He seemed like he was a little bit tired. But again, credit to Daniel Santos. He was there for the fight and cashed as a big-time underdog in that one. And for Daniel Santos, coming into the UFC, he was off a really long layoff. He had fought kind of varying levels of competition. But we know, or knew, that Santos was that King of Spin King. He had two body kick knockouts. Spinning body kick knockout. So Santos is a wild fighter. He's going to bring the action. And if you know Daniel Santos, you know that a fight against Johnny Munoz Jr. is a lot of fun, because where Daniel Santos can kind of thrive in some of the scrambles, not necessarily work in a lot of his own jiu-jitsu and takedowns, because he struggled there in the past. His one loss over with ACB or ACA at the time, it was a lot of the scrambles. It just kind of slowed him down a little bit. Johnny Munoz Jr., wrestling background, jiu-jitsu is the play. He got his black belt at 20 from his family gym being sequenced. And again, his father's nickname is Kid Kvenbo. His father's name is, you happen to guess it, yeah, it's Johnny Munoz. But he's really added to the tool belt going to Enthram Gym in Tijuana, working in some of that striking. I went back and watched some of the fights. And for Johnny Munoz Jr., he's kind of an unorthodox male bantamweight, to the fact that he likes to go in, close the distance with a lot. He just kind of throws a lot at you, a big flurry. He clinches for the body lock, for the trip. He's not a single leg, double leg takedown type of guy. But for Johnny Munoz Jr., when you watch him flow with his grappling, you look at the Jamie Simmons win, you look at some of these other ones, he's very, very good. And I know the last two fights, there's been a lot of this. Wacky waving inflatable tube man, not hitting the target. But he will throw a lot at you from distance. He threw a lot at the folks right there, Craig. I must say, that was a very long spiel. Here's the thing about this fight. I'm very curious to see how much success Munoz will have on the feet against a guy like Santos. Because Santos, we do talk about the spins a lot, but I like it when he keeps it simple. You know, like, even though his more extravagant strikes, if you will, are very nice, the left hook is very clean. The right straight is nice. When he is able to mix those uppercuts in and the knees at the middle, we saw how devastating they were in the last matchup. So that's the thing about Santos. It's almost kind of a discredit to just talk about the spins, because he is a very talented striker just on the feet in general. And if Munoz does go out there and not really commit to a lot of his strikes on the feet, and if Santos is getting a sense for that and really able to move out of the way of some of those strikes and answer with his own power shots, then Munoz might find himself starting to shoot from a little bit further away. And I think that's really going to be the key for Munoz. He's really going to have to mix in his boxing with his own wrestling attacks, because if he is starting to shoot from some of those longer distances, well, we saw it just in Santos's last fight, those knees up the middle can end this fight at any moment. But I am going to be curious about this. I do think Munoz is going to have a bit of a size advantage, and I think he's going to try to use the clinch in this fight to at least wear on a guy like Santos. Now, Santos is a bear cat. He's going to try to eat you up in that clinch. He's going to go to the body. He is a very active fighter. I know in the last fight he had, it did take him a little bit to kind of settle into it, but again, when he's at the ranges where he can do damage, he's really going to make use of those ranges. So again, for Munoz, I think it's a dangerous fight for him, but I do think he can have success at some different ranges. I just don't know how much success he's going to have on the feet, and if he's really going to be able to set things up on the feet to then help him get it. Yeah, and Johnny Munoz Jr. in the UFC so far, he's 2-2 against varying levels of competition. He came in on 4 days' notice to make his UFC debut against Nate Maness, replacing Ray Borg. Ray Borg got cut by the UFC there.
It's been a run.
And he got cut by Bellator, what, last week? So for Ray Borg, it's been tough. But for Johnny Munoz Jr. in the fight against Nate Maness, if he didn't have the low blow in the third round, who knows? I mean, he had a good case to winning that fight. He did a lot of clinching. He was
a stock gaining loss because he came in on short notice.
Yeah,
exactly.
He was 2-16 on takedown attempts. It was an interesting fight. He goes out there and he beats Jamie Simmons. He loses to Tony Gravely in a fight where it was that short shot on the inside that dropped him and finished him. And then his last time out, again, we talk about varying levels of competition. He's taking on Ludwig Chollignon, who a lot of people like coming off the Ultimate Fighter. I didn't understand it because it was just like throwing the jab and working some takedowns. And in that one, Munoz Jr. capitalized with some of the wrestling, with some of the striking. But again, the striking percentages, when he fought Ludwig Chollignon his last time out, 78 significant strikes landed out of 227. That's a 34% strike accuracy. Before that, in the fight that he had against Simmons, 14-71 for 19%. when it's at long range, he's throwing a lot at the mirror, but he doesn't really hit it.
And that's what I talk about when I talk about commitment to the shot. If he is just out there kind of pawing things out, remember Marina Moroz? Like, her striking percentages, she laid 11 strikes in a 15-minute fight.
And she does the Kia, so it really does sell it, but...
But my whole point is, if Munoz is out there just throwing volume for volume's sake, I do think Santos is the type of striker who would definitely make him pay for that at those ranges.
All right, so we get these two guys in a rebooked atmosphere at bantamweight. Willekak is going to be kind of in an awkward situation because of Spider-Man meme with John Castaneda. They're both on this card. For Johnny Munoz Jr., we talked about it with that last win where he ground out Ludwig Chollignon. If you do consider a matchup like this, Matt, I know Munoz Jr., like the low volume or the high volume, low accuracy striking. Santos, a lot of spinning stuff. It's kind of unfortunate because Mateus Mendonca was also supposed to be on this card. There are a few different shoot-the-box fighters that were supposed to be on it, but Santos is the only OG from the sauna. So if you do consider it, Santos still a pretty big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Willekak Santos.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over, and it is over. 1,349 total votes, 85% Santos, 72% by knockout. For the 15% that have Munoz, 56% by decision, 15% by submission, I'm actually surprised that not more fans have Munoz Jr. and that not more fans have him to win by submission as well.
I agree. I think this is a really close fight on paper. And honestly, I'm really happy that we get the rebooking because this should be a really entertaining fight. Munoz is there for a battle. So even if Santos is hitting him with big shots, like you said, he throws an insane level of volume himself. Now, he will Maria Moroz a little bit of it. I'm not saying he's going to land every shot he is throwing out there, but still, that volume and that kind of wall of punches should be a really difficult kind of puzzle for Daniel Santos to solve. So for me, I still do have Daniel Santos. I think he's the more devastating striker out of the two. And when he lands, yes, he also has some pretty big whiffs on his resume too. But when he lands, it does have devastating power. Two very well-rounded fighters though. And again, I'm very happy we got the rebooking of this.
Regardless, I want to see Johnny Munoz Jr. fight Ricky Tercios in a battle of the... But Matt, I also have Willekak Santos in the matchup. Make sure you let us know in the comment section who you have. Some big fights left on this card, including the one that I mentioned earlier, but now it's John Castaneda taking on Muin Gafurov. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Former UFC heavyweight champ Andre Arlovsky, he tends to the weeds. He waters the plants. He WD-40s the hinges. He does a great job at tending to the gate of the top 25 in the UFC's heavyweight division. And coming up this week, the Pitbull takes on Lord Kong, Dontayle Mays, who's now 9-5 with a no contest. The no contest, you ask? A split decision loss to Hamdi Abdelwahab. He was a juicy boy, so it's a no contest now. But if you do consider it for Dontayle Mays, he got rushed a little bit in that fight against Hamdi. So then his last time out, he takes on a slip sliding away Augusto Sakai. And in that matchup, Augusto Sakai showed why he was a former top 10 heavyweight. Sakai looked amazing. Going back and watching that fight this morning, I thought, Dontayle Mays is like a plus 115. He's probably going to show up. Nope. Sakai closed the distance, pushed it up against the fence. When it was at distance, he was landing all the strikes he wanted to, and there wasn't much output back from Mays. And I thought to myself while I watched it, I went, geez, doesn't this guy have a judo base? Like, shouldn't he be able to shuck out of some of these bad positions?
How often do we see people use judo in MMA, though?
Well, you would think for Dontayle Mays, a guy that's out of Jackson Wink MMA, look what happens if you can combine any sort of grappling and offensive takedowns. You can get up to the top 15. Shamil Durkhimov did it. Jaltan Almeida's doing it with his takedowns.
They have way better backs.
Making it look easy. But for Mays, he strikes, and then occasionally he'll go for the takedown. Now, you saw it against Josh Prezen, when he was able to go out there and do the digital underground, a little bit of the Humpty Dance. But by and large, for Mays, it's a lot of big actions. When he's winning, pressing it up against the cage, threatening with some dirty boxing, back out at open space, he lands some of those big shots. He's a guy that fought three times on Contender Series, once against Alan Crowder. He got finished. Twice, he ends up getting a win. Third time, he takes on former Chelsea goalkeeper Ricardo Prezel, and he ends up into the UFC to then lose. But if you do consider it overall, It's most likely going to be the footwork and the outside movement boxing of a guy like Andrei Arlovsky, who had won 4 in a row before he lost his last time out against a pretty darn good fighter, if you ask me, right?
The only thing that I do worry about with Arlovsky at this stage of his career is how much longer is the output still going to be there? Because that's the thing that he has been able to hold on to, right? It's weird. Normally, power is the last thing to go in heavyweights, and hell, Andrei Arlovsky was a pretty damn powerful guy in his prime, but he has been able to shift his skill set very similar to like a CC Sabathia with the New York Yankees. CC won the Cy Young when he was younger, went to the Yankees, was good early, but then as his velocity got slower...
Mixing those pitches.
Exactly. He mixed his pitches. He became much more of, and this is just a very common term, the man was a baller. And for Andrei Arlovsky, he does do a really good job at overwhelming his opponents, which is a wide variety of strikes. He's a guy who can throw the jab. He just puts a lot in your face. And I can't believe I'm comparing Aljamain Sterling, one of the best fighters in the world, to Andrei Arlovsky currently, but you get the idea from a striking perspective. It's more volume over power at this stage of Arlovsky's career. He's going to put a lot in your face, and he's going to force you to be in more of a defensive shell so that you can't respond with your own big shots. Because Arlovsky... let's just be honest, he doesn't have the greatest of chins. And I know he hasn't been knocked out as of late, but we have seen when he gets hit clean, he does go down. Now, he does do a good job of avoiding the clean shots. I think that is fair to say because he'll get wobbled in some fights, but he does a very intelligent job defensively. He'll shell up. He doesn't mind backing up to the cage. He'll put himself in a bit of a vulnerable position just to make sure he doesn't get knocked out. And that's pretty good if you don't lose the fight.
If you look at his last two losses to Tom Aspinall, I mean, Mark Smith gave Andrei Arlovsky every single opportunity to stand it in the first round, and he did. And then in the second round, you had a quick Aspinall takedown into a submission. Arlovsky was definitely rocked in that first round when he got hit. If you look at his last time out, I say a really good fighter, I buried the lead. It's Marco Sergio de Lima, who's going to be taking on Derek Lewis on the main card of a pay-per-view coming up. And Marcos rocks him, drops him, and then he ends up getting the submission win out of it. So Arlovsky, when it's been those types of fighters... with a heavy, heavy power and big right hands, he struggled. But you look at the wins, Chase Sherman, Carlos Felipe, Jared Vandera, and then Jake Collier. I know I had said that the Jake Collier win was one of the worst decisions I've ever seen.
But all of his fights as of late have been very close win, loser, draw.
They have. The big, well, not those losses. No, they haven't been close.
No, but for the most part, even when Andrei Arlovsky wins, you're sitting there thinking, okay, are they really going to give him this one?
Yeah, there was a time, like the 2004-2005 range, where he beats Tim Sylvia for the interim heavyweight belt, then he gets promoted to the overall undisputed heavyweight belt with a win over Justin Sellers, and then at UFC 55 Fury with Craig Hummer was the broadcaster with Joe Rogan. Craig Hummer. In that one, neither one of them knew what happened against Paul Buonatello because he throws that short right hand that drops Buonatello, and then it's like, what happened? And it's very anticlimactic, climactic, as Joe Rogan said that night. So for Arlovsky, a lot of movement on the outside. For Dante Mays, a lot of those big actions to try and close the distance. Mays, for some stretch of the imagination, is favored to win this fight right now.
I have Arlovsky. I'll just let it be known right now.
Let's look at the topology votes. I'm going to say over under 70% Arlovsky.
I hope they're not that high because it'll make me regret just saying I have Arlovsky so confidently. I'm going to say under for the love of God. Oh, no.
Oh, my sweet goodness gracious.
What is
1,427 total Tapology votes. 81% Andrei Arlovsky, 83% by
decision. I just got gaslit by the Tapology votes. I don't know what's real anymore. This is my big issue. If Andrei Arlovsky is able to throw the leg kick and pitter-patter on the outside, he can win this fight by decision without a shadow of doubt in my mind. Because Mays doesn't necessarily have an answer for a lot of those kicks on the outside. If Arlovsky can just kind of blind him with the jab and the straight right, and I'm not even saying if they land, just blind him so he keeps his hands up and he's not throwing his own offense, I think Arlovsky can win this fight. That's why I do have him by decision. It's probably going to be a close one because that's where all of his fights have been as of late. But again, Andrei Arlovsky from the age of 21 could get knocked out by one shot. The guy's 44. Like, how many professional athletes succeed until they're 45?
Like, the wildest Randy part Johnson. Of it is, he had all the success in the UFC. He leaves the UFC on a win. Ends up fighting with Affliction. He has a win over Ben Rothwell. He loses to Fedor. Then he goes to Strikeforce, loses to Brett Rogers. Sergey Kharitonov was the last win. The middle win, they're all three losses. Brett Rogers, Bigfoot Silva, and then Sergey Kharitonov. Fights all over the world, comes back into the UFC, had that big losing streak. Then...
beat Brendan Schaub by split decision.
It's been close. Yeah, a beast of a fighter. But Matt, if you do consider it overall...
are you with me on this? Are we picking a 44-year-old man to win a cage fight? When I say it like that, I don't have the confidence I did before.
Yeah, I think it's going to end up being a really close fight, and I think that Dontell Mays is going to clip Andre Arlovsky with something. I'll go with Dontell Mays in the matchup. I don't like it. This is a chintzy little fight. We're split on the pick. Matt going with Andre Arlovsky, yet naturalized United States citizen. I'm going to go with Dontell Mays in the matchup. Yeah, let us know who you have down below in the comment section. Some big fights on this card, including Kai Kara-France taking on Amir Albazi in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
A short notice UFC debut for the third fighter out of Tajikistan to represent the country in the UFC in 2023 after Nurullo Aliyev and one. I mean, we're talking about the Jaguar paw, Loic Radjabov. It is Tajik, if you didn't know, Muin Gafarov, and he's going to be taking on Sexy Mexi John Castaneda, who was originally due Mateus Mendonca in the matchup. So you do look at it. Again, this fight was announced in the fact that Gafarov has a week and a half notice to make this debut. But all things considered, Muin Gafarov is a known commodity for MMA fans. And if you don't know, well, you're going to enjoy it, hopefully, because for Gafarov, he makes his one championship debut at 19 years old against Reese McLaren. Loses that fight because he gets out-grappled.
But wait, Craig, is Reese McLaren good?
So Reese McLaren wins by decision and gets a title shot off
He's
of that.
He's very good.
Then Gafarov takes on Kevin Bellingon, who was coming off a title shot. And he loses that fight because does he get out-grappled? No, he gets out-struck.
Yeah.
But the guy's 20 years old. Then he wins a plethora of fights. He ends up with one once more, and he loses to John Lineker, who was coming off a close loss to Corey Sandhagen in Lineker's one championship debut. So Muin Gafarov took on a who's who over with one championship. He's taken on a who's who since. He ended up on Contender Series a couple of years ago. Takes on the Canadian Chad Ann Heliger. Loses a split decision in a fight that was... it was back and forth. You could have made an argument that Gafarov won two rounds. You could make an argument that Ann Heliger won two rounds. But overall, Gafarov, a minus 450 favorite, he didn't win that fight. So he's got to go back and reinvent himself. He takes some time off, ends up with the LFA. Two straight finish wins. He becomes their vacant Bantamweight champ. And if you look at it in terms of the lineage of LFA Bantamweight champs, it starts with Leandro Higo, then Ricky Simon, Casey Kenny. The lineage, it's there. Zviad Lajisvili, who ended up in the UFC, but he was a juicy boy.
He was.
So he couldn't be around for much longer. But Muin Gafarov is such an interesting prospect because what got him into MMA was the fact that his uncle was the president of the Combat Sambo Federation of Tajikistan. And he said, don't get into football. Get into Combat Sambo. And he did. And he became a world champion, not a once, but a twice. 2013, 2014. I'll throw the graphic up there because in 2013, he wins at 62 kgs. Among the winners in that tournament, Yaroslav Amosov won his division. In the second time out, Pavel Kusha, who I'm going to talk about because he fought Abubakar Nurmagomedov, won an apartment and $3,000 cash. Matt, that's the weirdest thing I've ever seen anybody win ever.
No, shout out our grandfather one time at darts. He won four steaks and like some hash browns because that's what they give away at a rec center.
Yeah, but that's a rec center darts tournament, not a world championship in Sambo. Here, Pavel, here's the keys to an apartment. How long do you think the lease was?
You don't want four ribeyes?
Month to month. And we paid for one a month.
I love the fact that they're giving Gafarov the Sexy Mexi though for his UFC debut because this is no easy fight by any measure. And when I first thought of this fight, I thought, oh, they're kind of giving Gafarov, maybe not an underhand toss, but a favorable matchup. And then I started thinking about it a little bit more. Is the Sexy Mexi ever completely out of a fight? Not really. Does he make it difficult for his opponent? Yes. And the thing that I really like about Castaneda too is he has those great boxing combinations. And the thing for Gafarov is if he gets on the inside to land his own shots, and Gafarov does have interesting striking. He's got to throw from odd angles, very big looping shots. Will throw in combinations sometimes, but does overemphasize, I would say, the power shot a little bit too much. Because while he's searching for those big power shots, there's a large window for his opponent to counter on. And that's something John Castaneda could easily do if he does find himself reading the punches well on the back foot.
Well, and we've seen from Gafarov in these fights, his big overhand right, if it hits the target,
oh my God,
you're done. If it misses, there's a big reset to it. We've seen fighters knee him up the middle. We've seen fighters take him down. And that's the craziest part. For Gafarov, you might think, okay, Combat Sambo world champ like Khabib Nurmagomedov. No, it's more like Azamat Mirzakhanov. It's a lot of big actions on the outside to close the distance and not necessarily going to work in a lot of the wrestling. Now, Gafurov does one thing that I absolutely love, win, lose, or draw. He gets taken out a lot. I don't love that. But to get out of the bad positions, he goes leg lock, so much so that his opponents freak out, and then he gets to either go for a single leg out of that, or he gets to pop back up to his feet and fight to see another day. And for Gafurov, the weirdest part is, if you're an opponent, look at it this way. Well, he has 18 wins, and he's never won one by leg lock. So how good's it really going to be? But everybody freaks out every single time he does it. Gafurov can waste minutes off of his back. That is another kind of a chintzy thing. When he gets the takedown, he likes to threaten for the back. He likes to try for arm bars as well. He's been in some tricky armbar positions himself. But the best part out of Gafurov, though, is he tends to be in these fights no matter the first round, the second round, the third round, and so on. But I do worry a lot. Again, it is on a week and a half notice. If you look at it for John Castaneda, he wrestled at Minnesota State Mankato. You know Mankato to be a hockey, like, mecca. But for John Castaneda, that tricky, tricky southpaw, we were excited about him coming into the UFC. Couldn't close the distance against Nathaniel Wood in his debut. No shame in that. Fight. He beat Eddie Wineland. Now, late career Eddie Wineland's weird because 2017 on, who beat him? Sean O'Malley beat him. John Dodson was able to beat him. Cody Stamann beat him. And Turbo Perez beat him. All four of those guys lost their next fight. But John Castaneda won his next fight. He's the only one to break the Wineland curse. But then his last time out, he takes on Daniel Santos, who's also on this card. An awesome first round. He kept landing the power shots. He nearly finished Santos, but in the second round, knees to the body and a lot of work up against the cage. That was to his demise. That fight was at a catchweight of 140. So watch the weight, I guess, throughout this week.
For both, yeah.
For both guys. But yeah, it's going to be a really interesting fight because I've seen a lot of love online for Muin Gafurov. Contender series before, so on and so forth. There's definitely going to be a wave of fans for Gafurov in this matchup, but this isn't as cut and dry, I think, as maybe you think if you don't watch the tape.
Well, it's definitely a fight where I would probably pick Gafurov if it wasn't on short notice, put it that way. But the fact that it's, what, 10 days? Like, that's not a lot of time to get ready for a cage fight. Normally, guys have 2 months to do it. So, for Gafurov, I think the short notice aspect will be difficult. But I'm glad we have spoken about his resume. Because you might look at the four losses on his way into the UFC and think, oh, really? Some guy with a bunch of losses? You can lose, and it makes you better over time. If you're young, especially, which he is, he did improve after all those losses. And I do think that's a really important thing to bring up as well. So, I think this is an extremely well-matched fight for his UFC debut to be taking place under.
If you do look at it, Matt, this fight was, as I said, just announced not that long ago. You consider it for a guy like John Castaneda. He was favored to beat Mateus Mendonca, but not a lot of odds out there yet. So we have a look at the fan vote to give us a help over on Topology. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 60% for John Castaneda.
I'll say over.
And it is the opposite. Wow. 873 total votes, 69% Gafurov, 21% by decision, 69% by knockout for the 31% that I've Castaneda, 67% by decision. And Castaneda, again, the former Combate bantamweight champ. He had the fights with Jose Aldo. He fought a really high-level competition over there with Combate. He's one of those guys, as you said, he mixes it head to body really well, left hook to the body. You saw him with the knees and with everything against Miles Johns. It was a knee in the third round. He drops Johns. Then he gets the arm triangle choke. He set it up, and then Johns, holding on to his leg, gives up on him and ends up getting just choked out. So some crazy stuff there. Went over Marcelo Rojo over with Combate as well. So if you look at this matchup, Matt, I think this is now like the best fight on the card, or at least in the top three. Who's the pick in this fight?
I have a really hard time with this fight because, again, I think Gafurov would win if he had 2 months to get ready for it. Now, does he win if he has 2 weeks to get ready for it? Does he win if he has a month to get ready for it? I think his striking on the inside will be good enough to not get clipped by some of the combinations of Castaneda. I feel like I did set this video up as a very pro-Castaneda pick, so hopefully me picking Gafurov will give people a good excuse to go out there and pick Castaneda, because I think he can have good success in the back feet, and that's why I bring up how well-rounded he is. He can finish you on the feet, on the mat, and what I do like about him is he can hurt you on the feet and then finish the fight on the mat. That's a skill set that not every fighter can possess, and it shows that, hey, you don't need to have the greatest level of wrestling to be able to get your to get the fight to the mat. If you can hurt guys with your hands or your legs, I think you can have success. The more I'm talking, the more I want to pick Castaneda, so I'm just going to pick Gafurov and end it there.
The most fun I had today rewatching fights was watching Muin Gafurov fights to get ready for this one. I mean, the takedowns for and against, they can be an issue. His last time out there, in a phone booth, within like 3 feet, he throws a spinning back kick to the body. Heel hits the liver. Opponent goes down. Gafurov's your champ. It's a lot of fun there, but it's a lot of big actions. The craziest part about it for Gafurov is when he's on the outside, nothing happens. Absolutely nothing happens. I think John Castaneda, with the leg kicks, the pot shots, I think he's going to have a lot of success. I just need to see these two guys on Friday weigh in. That's exactly going to be a big decider in the matchup. We're split on the pick. Matt going with Tajikistan's own Muin Gafurov. I'm going with John Castaneda. There's going to be a lot of people out there slamming the steering wheel, like hitting the table. You guys split picks. We don't talk about them before we pick them. But in this one, again, we are split. Some big-time matchups on the card. Kaikar France taking on Amir Albazi in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Not Douglas Silva de Andrade, my guy. But coming up this weekend, we have Capoeira, Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. And why do I say Douglas Silva de Andrade? Well, because Matt, Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos, I'll keep saying his name, is your guy. He's kind of an aficionado. So what can you tell us to start the video off about the man representing Brazil in this match?
I can tell you that between the ages of 28 and I'd say up to 34, this man could offer you a competitive fight anybody in the whole entire rankings. And I argue that even though he may not have reached the heights of some of the other ranked fighters in the division, that the best version of Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos could probably have beaten the majority of people in the top 50.
Zaleski dos Santos from 2016 to 2019 won 7 fights in a row, and he's kind of like Walter Waite's Eddie Alvarez. He was the underground king for a really long time. He had that knockout win over Sean Strickland, which aged so well. But recently, he's kind of come up against some stumbling blocks. He loses to Li Jingliang. And Li Jingliang, I mean, he wants to be a lightweight now all of a sudden, but he really, really struggled in that one, got dropped multiple times, and then he fought a fight against Muslim Salikov in a mirror.
It was awful.
And nothing happened. But Zaleski's last time out, he took on France's Benoit Saint-Denis, and in that matchup, I mean, referee Kiziliev,
he straight up beat him with a inch of his leg.
It was bad.
It was really bad. I will say this about Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. What you should know about him is he reminds me a lot of Edson Barboza. And I say it for this reason. A lot of people are going to focus on the flashiness of the kicks, right? He has a good leg kick. He has a really nice switch kick to the body, similar to Edson Barboza. Great spins as well. But his boxing, I think, is quite underrated. When he gets in the pocket and allows his combinations to flow, he's someone who can get real damage done, primarily with the hands. Now, he will get a little bit trigger happy with the overhand, right? It's something he does like to go to over and over again. But hey, when it lands, not a lot of guys can stand up to it. But that's always been the thing about Zaleski that I don't think people have given full credit for. Because, yes, he did get knocked out by Li Jingliang, and that was a bad performance. And that's what I'll say about him. He does have kind of two versions to him, right? He'll have one version where he's a little bit hesitant. He won't do a lot of volume. He'll be cognizant of the takedown, and I do think that's a big reason as to why we don't see the overwhelming volume that we did see in the Strickland fight and definitely the Benoit Saint-Denis fight. But that's been the big story for Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos. His career to me is similar to a Santiago Ponzinibbio, but maybe like a fight back.
Yeah.
Because both guys would probably reach lofty heights, but I feel like injuries took away a lot in inactivity, especially for Zaleski. He'd lose, take a long time off, come back, look good. Take time off.
Yeah, but Santiago Ponzinibbio didn't have a 1 year USADA suspension due to Austrian use.
No, that I just mean for Zaleski, the inconsistency, I guess, has really been a big issue for him. And it has been unfortunate because, again, at one point, he was thought of as a top contender. After that Strickland fight, this guy was as hot as anybody. Now, the Li Jingliang fight, I do think, is just a pretty good precursor for how you do beat a guy like Zaleski. If you get on the inside, I know I just got done applauding his boxing, but a lot of his boxing is done from the outside. He's going to use the jab, step in with the overhand. If you can get on the inside, make things uncomfortable for him, disrupt his rhythm with some clinch work, with something Abubakar Nurmagomedov can do, it does limit some of the offense of a guy like Eliseu Zaleski.
Forget about the overhand. Look at the right cross. I think that's the most underrated thing that jumps off the page. When you go back and you watch the Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos fights, if you're going to go for a leg kick, he'll meet you every time with that right cross when you have your hand kind of stuck out, and that's where he's able to do some really good work. If you look at it for Abubakar Nurmagomedov, We talked about him not that long ago. He was supposed to have a fight. It ended up, it fell apart, and that one was going to be against Carlson Harris back in March.
I was excited for that.
Harris ended up fighting. Nurmagomedov did not. But for Nurmagomedov, his last time out, took on Gaji Omargadriev in that one. Maybe lost the first round, rallied round two, round three. But the biggest story around Nurmagomedov, his time with World Series and the PFL, he was a massive favorite in the large majority of his matchups. He was over a 1,400 favorite in a fight that he lost to Pavel Kisha. How's that apartment, that $3K making? That's called a callback. But he ends up getting a win over Jonathan Weston, big favorite again. He draws in a two-round fight against Bojan Veličković. And then off a draw, the UFC went, yeah, Red Rover, bring this guy over.
Right now.
Goes for a takedown against David Zavada, gets submitted by David Zavada. But if you do look at it overall for Nurmagomedov, a loss to Zavada, a loss to Pavel Kisha, and a loss years ago against Magomed Mustafayev.
Yep.
If my guy Mustafayev fought Elize Zaleski dos Santos in the year of our Lord 2023, I would be all about it.
Fire
my brain would probably explode. Every time I get teased with a Mustafayev fight getting booked, there's been about five of them in the last 3 years, I get rock hard with emotion. I've got a phoner, and I don't know what to do with myself, and then they all go away. But in that fight against Mustafayev, Nurmagomedov's going for takedown after takedown after takedown. He gets three, and then an unfortunate cut. That's the end of the fight. So it was a bad way to go. But ultimately, if you watch Nurmagomedov fight, he was a boxer's delight when he fought Jared Gooden, who had his hands down at his ankles. But other than that, we haven't seen Nurmagomedov fight that way. Now, could that be a progression at AKA? You look at his Instagram, he's still training with Khabib, Umar Nurmagomedov. But now, the level up in training. 170's best. Bilal Muhammad is training with them over there. So pretty cool
Very good to see there.
But for Nurmagomedov, I think he has gotten better with his hands career's gone on. I don't know if Elize Zaleski dos Santos where you want to test that, but maybe it is.
For me, though, it comes down to how does Elizio make him pay when he does try to use that striking, right? Because Zaleski has good ground skills. They're not great. Let's just call them what they are. He's a guy who will go for offensive submissions. He does take the back well. Like, his offensive grappling is quite good, but he can get held down. He doesn't have great moves off of his back. And, of course, that's an area where Nurmagomedov can get him down and use a lot of that groundwork. But if a Abubakar does try to showcase that jab and use a lot of the movement, I think it might turn a really entertaining fighter into a really boring fighter, which I think would just be terrible for everybody. But it might be the best way for him to win, because if he is able to get in and get out and threaten with enough takedowns, we've seen Zaleski become a shell of himself where he's not throwing a lot of volume. And if Abubakar can just threaten enough, and I don't even mean have a ton of success, right? I don't mean he has to drop Zaleski. He might not even have to take him down double-digit times. Just threaten enough with the takedown to force him to not really move his hips as much, because he does like to do a lot of that offset movement where he'll kind of go for the fake overhand, mix it in with a switch kick, and it does do great work. But if you're throwing a lot of wasted movement against a guy who can definitely take you down throughout the majority of the fight, I think that movement might be better if you just kind of stay upright and use your base.
So there's going to be a lot of those Spider-Man moments out there in the corridors, John Castaneda and then Daniel Santos. You're also going to have that for coaches, because Elizeu Zaleski dos Santos' coach at CM System or CM Academy is Cristiano Marcelo, who fought years ago. His only UFC win was over Reza Madadi, who's going to be coaching Guram Kutataladze coming up this week.
I always kind of liked Reza Madadi. Like, he was a tough and grimy fighter, you know? He never quit.
Like guys like Reza Madadi and Brad Pickett doing the coaching thing. Matt,
Jim
the odds on this one, they're about at par, so it is a pick, and we have a look at the Tapology votes. I mean, it seems like good value, again, on Nurmagomedov coming from being a minus 1,400 in his career. Again, the Tapology votes surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% for Nurmagomedov here.
I think it'll... I want to say under, but I'm going to say over.
It is, right? It's close. It's slightly under. 1,421 total votes, 57% Nurmagomedov, 78% by decision for the 43% that have Zaleski, 70% by decision. And again, while Nurmagomedov has one TKO loss on his career, it was because there was a cut that was too big. It was like that Liz Carmouche Valentina Shevchenko fight. So when you do try and make a pick on this one, you make it with the head and not the heart. So what is the pick?
And that's why I've got Nurmagomedov. I just think he can do the right kind of techniques that force Zaleski to not throw as much. And even in the Sean Strickland fight, if you go back and watch that, Zaleski's not landing a ton of strikes outside of the ultimate knockout blow, which is that spinning back kick. Now, if he is able to land one of those high velocity strikes, of course this fight's going to be over. The guy's 36, but he still has kind of dominant power when he's it will land his hands. Look at the Benoit St. Denis fight. I know it didn't end by knockout, but it probably should have on multiple occasions. But I do think Nurmagomedov can threaten enough with the takedown, mix his jab and his striking in enough to just force Oleski to not throw as much.
No, and it's a big matchup for Nurmagomedov. You can see that from the graphics. 2-1 UFC record versus 9-3. With Oleski, he did get taken down by St. Denis at the start of the fight, but the scary thing for me with Nurmagomedov is he's got a little bit of that Ramazan Ameev. I'm a kickboxer as the fights go on. He did that with Omar Gadriev, who in his own right is a great grappler, but I don't like that for Nurmagomedov as the fight goes on, even against the 36-year-old Zaleski, whose last one was in 2021 over St. Denis. And then last March, he was booked to take on Munir Lazez, but in March, that positive USADA test for Osterin. So we'll see how Zaleski's able to mix it up. I think the striking can still get it done. And he shaved his head and he shaved his beard and he looks like a totally different man. So Matt, we're split on this one. I'm going with Brazil's Capoeira, Zaleski dos Santos. You have Nurmagomedov. 863,000 Instagram followers for Nurmagomedov.
Look at him go.
I don't know who they are, but they're out there. Let us know who you have for this fight. And then our next one. Oh, the aforementioned Guram Kutateladze is going to be taking on Jamie Mullerkey, and I am amped up about it. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Absolute banger. Just outside the top 15 of the lightweight division, we have the Georgian Viking Guram Kutateladze taking on a surging Jamie Mullerkey, and this should be a very, very good fight because we've seen Jamie Mullerkey fight up to the level of his competition. That fight that he had, a fight in the night against Brad Riddell, was absolutely wild. He had a great one against Michael Johnson. Those two were fight of the nights. He also gained a performance bonus in his second round finish over Devontae Smith. Jamie Mullerkey's one of those guys that, like, who is it? Run DMC? Bring the noise. I mean, that's exactly what Mullerkey does. Now, his last time out, he fought the biggest head scratcher of a UFC debutant, Francisco Prado. And I don't know why Prado got Mullerkey, but in that matchup, he fought kind of a good game plan. He didn't, like, see red and go wild throughout that one. So a good win for Mullerkey, but nowhere near the level of competition where Guram Kutateladze is to Francisco Prado. But if you do consider it, some people might take umbrage with the graphic that I have up there for Kutateladze because he is the Georgian Viking, and I know when he was young, he's from Georgia, lived a time in Russia, went back to Georgia, and then to Sweden. If you go to Guram's website, in 2019, he became a Swedish citizen. So that's why I put Georgia and Sweden on there, just kind of giving the shine to his website and I guess his life story. But if you look at a guy like Guram Kutateladze, a very interesting background of Japanese jiu-jitsu, but also the striking prowess with the fact that he was on the Swedish national Muay Thai, or I guess it was the Russian national Muay Thai team. Guram's one of those fighters that no matter where the fight is, he's going to make it ultra competitive.
It's one of those things, though, where it is a little frustrating watching him fight because he has every skill set you could possibly ask for, right? He has devastating strikes when he is able to land on the feet. He has great technique behind them, really devastating kicks. Like, I would say one of the harder kickers pound for pound in the sport. He has great takedown defense, but there are some of the in-betweens where he might be lacking on any given night, where his volume won't overwhelm you. He'll throw a big strike, kind of get caught on a takedown, and the more I think about it, the more I think that's the big thing that Kutateladze does have to work on. He is great at defending takedowns, but it's that separation of distance where he can reset and start striking again, because we saw Gamrot was able to have good success when he was able to close that distance.
I mean, a Polish national wrestling champ. Except,
I'm not saying he's just any guy, but my whole point is when Gamrot was hurt by some of those strikes, he would shoot in for takedowns, wrap up the legs of Kutateladze, and just really withstand some of the storm by shooting for a lot of takedowns. And for Mullerkey, he's a weird fighter because it's another case in this fight. He's never given the respect by odds makers. He probably won't be given the respect by Tapology voters, because if you look at him in a silhouette, you could probably figure out who it is, right? He is oddly stiff for being a really good striker, and I do think Jamie Mullerkey is a talented striker. I know he's been finished, let's just say, numerous times in the past, but it's the pretty good fighters when you actually look at who's been able to go out there and knock out Jamie Mullerkey. He doesn't really wow you with his striking like a Yair Rodriguez or a Max Holloway, but when he lands punches, they're pretty devastating. It is kind of wild to see. He has a really nice straight right down the middle. middle. He will kind of throw that outside leg kick and then use that to step into some of his strikes. And I do think that the odd skill set of Malarkey might just be enough to offset some of the technique that Kutatalanse has. Because if Guram's on the outside blasting kicks to the leg, that's going to make it a really difficult night for Malarkey. But if Jamie's able to get on the inside, make it ugly, uses just kind of wonking. But again, I mean this in the best way possible because he is definitely an effective striker. If he can do that to get on the inside and primarily use his boxing, I think he can make it really uncomfortable for Guram on the feet because Guram has, I would say, really heavy hands, but he thrives the most on the feet when he's able to incorporate the kicks as well.
I mean, if you do look at it for Guram, he won his first two pro fights, then he loses to Oliver Enkamp, who ends up in the UFC, then he loses to Powell Kiliak, and if you want to see a wild topology page, go look at Powell's. It's not glaring right now, but look at the start. It was great. And then ultimately, Guram goes out there, wins a multitude of fights in a row. He beats Felipe Silva over with Brave, a UFC vet. He knocks him out in the first minute of the first round. And then he ends up in the UFC taking on the then undefeated Mateusz Gamrot. And you kind of touched on how good Gamrot's grappling wrestling is. It's wild, and you never see it unless you play UFC 4 and you're a heavyweight. I never see overhand lefts from an orthodox stance, but that's what Guram was able to land against Mateusz that was able to drop him. Then he did his little roll, and then he got right back up. So for Guram, the big thing is when you watch his fights, he did lose his last time out by split decision to Demir Ismagulov. Ismagulov ended up getting ranked number 12th in the world after beating Kutataladze. Yeah, the MMA decisions. I mean, Guram's win over Gamrot, 14-3, scored at 29-28 for Kutataladze. His fight against Ismagulov, 11-4, scored at 4 Kutataladze. But going back and looking at it, he catches Demir with a sneaky little left hook, Demir catches him with a left hook, cuts up Kutataladze, but regardless of just that damage, Guram looked really good in that first round. To me, it was all of the volume, but the fact that Guram kind of does wear damage to his nose and to his eyes quite a bit, so we'll see how that all kind of works itself out in this matchup. Guram, of course, representing his own gym that he owns in House of Samurai, but he also cross trains at All Stars with Reza Madadi. This is just a Reza Madadi.
Shout out Reza.
Handing him his flowers this weekend. But if you do look at it again, Irigumi Go Jujutsu was the background for 1 Guram Kutataladze. I doubt we see this one go on the feet, on the mat. But if we do, you could get some really interesting scrambles out of these two big guys for the lightweight division. The Georgian Viking is a pretty darn big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 85% Kutataladze.
I'll say under, but it'll be a favorite.
It is slightly over. 1,473 total votes, 86% for Guram, 45% by decision, 44% by knockout for the 14% that are Malarkey, 40% by knockout, 45% by decision. So who do you have in the matchup?
I do have Guram, because here's the thing. Malarkey, I think, can make it uncomfortable on the inside if he is able to get in that position and really dominate it. But we've seen him get hurt, and he doesn't recover necessarily the greatest once he does get rocked. So I don't know if he is going to be able to shoot some of those more panicky-type takedowns to get his head out of danger if he is able or if he is wobbled in that first round. So for me, I do have Guram, but I think it's a close fight. Again, I don't think the oddsmakers are giving Malarkey the respect he deserves. I do like his volume. I think he's an uncomfortable puncher. He's a really unorthodox fighter who I really enjoy watching. So I think this, for me, this is one of the fight of the night.
I mean, if we had like Mike Goldberg still in the UFC, he'd probably say that Guram kicks like a mule. He'd throw out there one of those. But if you look at it for Guram, a long layoff from when he fought against, the win that he had against Gamrot to then his fight against Ismagulov. Injuries. Now it's been almost a year since that fight against Ismagulov that was very, very close. I do have Kutataladze because I think the leg kicks are going to be a big difference maker. And I know that Malarkey is bigger, has a bigger frame, longer reach, but when Kutataladze breaks that reach, he's able to land to the body and to the head with his boxing combinations. As long as he doesn't hang around for that extra half second, which we have seen him do in the pocket, Malarkey could be able to land that big right hand. But I do have Kutataladze in the matchup. We're in agreement on that one. A big matchup in the lightweight division. Rankings on the lookout for both of these guys. Some big time fights left on this card. Kaikar France taking on Amir Albazi in that main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
Whoa!
flyweight scrap coming up from the UFC's Apex. Ketlin Souza gets the fast track. The former Invicta flyweight champ signed with the promotion in early May, and all of a sudden she has a fight within a month against killer Karine Silva. And if you do consider this matchup, Silva, she fought a who's who on the regional scene. She ends up on Contender Series. Doesn't look good against Kihui, but in that one, gets the win in the second round, books her ticket to the UFC, and then gets a first round win over Pollyanna Battaglio. And Silva, back not that long ago, was supposed to take on Priscilla Cachoeira. Silva shows up on weight at 126, Cachoeira shows up at 130, and then as the day progresses, the fight is called off. So ultimately, now she goes from fighting Zombie Girl to Esquitindinha. It's very difficult for an English speaker to pronounce Portuguese nickname, but when I do look at this fight, Matt, I know a lot of people are going to say that Souza is going to be at a disadvantage size-wise, but that's pretty much the story in every single one of her fights. She did used to fight at strawweight. Silva, in her own right, has strawweight and bantamweight experience. Souza does have one bantamweight fight, and it's against somebody that probably a lot of MMA fans know in Gisele Mojea. But if you do look at it for both of these women, they both hit really hard.
They do.
They both can grapple. I mean, you have a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt out of Ketlin Souza. She just got that this year, so some pretty cool stuff there out of the blue corner. But when I kind of looked at this fight on the page, I went, okay, I know Souza a little bit from Invicta, but I don't know her all that well. I know the losses that she has, and I'll highlight those as I go along. But Karine Silva, it feels like a bit of a jump. And then I went back and I watched tape study for both of them, and it feels like a really well-matched fight in the end.
It should be a fun fight, and it's one that should deliver for the fans at flyweight, because flyweight needs new contenders, and both these fighters could represent one of those new contenders. Like, Alexa Grasso just beat someone who was widely considered unbeatable. No one knows what the heck's going to happen next. Like, Karine Silva has looked really good throughout her UFC tenure, and I have been sold because... Throughout one round of her UFC tenure, and this is why. I think there is something to be said for just going in there and Jessica Andrade your opponent. Now, for Silva, she can close that distance and land those big bombs. And I do think there is a limit and there is a ceiling to how far that might be able to take you in some of the divisions, especially in this one. But for Silva, I think she can have success on the feet with some of those strikes.
Did we watch that same fight?
What?
She waits the entire first round, strikes on the outside, and then lands a right-hand good shot, gets it on the ground, and gets a submission win.
But that's my whole point. If you could threaten enough from the outside, I think Souza is the more varied striker out of these two. But for Silva to not only have the size advantage, but to have a power threat with her too, I just think it's going to be difficult for Souza to really be able to throw her strikes on the outside. That's all.
Souza does a great job on the outside. She always mixes in different shots to her combinations. You saw it when she was fighting over with Invicta. She fought a fighter that everyone has fought. Misha Tate fought her with Strikeforce. It's Maiju Suotama. Now, was she really old? Yeah. I mean, she was in her late 30s. And did she take the fight on short notice? Yeah. And would Souza do an Invicta title shot in Souza's debut? Yes. But she ended up with Suotama. Nonetheless, she wins all three rounds. It was a decision where she landed on the outside, and when Suotama went for the takedowns, Souza was able to defend them and mix it up as she went along. Then she takes on the warhorse, Christina Williams, of Bellator fame, and in that matchup, she did quite a bit. 50-45, 49-46, 48-47, the judges' decisions, but Souza really did mix in her strike in that matchup. But if you watch the end of the second round, the elbows from ground and pound when she was in mount, the slice that you had on Williams' face, it was disgusting. But the thing that I really liked out of it, and when you talk about the striking being varied and different all the time, Julie Kedzie mentioned that kind of drunken monkey type of striking where it's all over the place and it is different. And then Megan Anderson goes, she reminds me a lot of a guy I trained with for the longest time, Tim Elliott. So a little bit of a connection to this card with Ketlin Souza, but if you look at Souza's overall career, she fought Ariane Carnelosi, and that was Carnelosi's springboard into the UFC. And in that fight, Carnelosi blitzes her to start the fight. And after that, round one, round two, Souza wins. And then round three, Souza's winning until she gets hit by the fatal knockout blow. If you do look at it for Karine Silva, really early on in her career, and I'll throw it up there, she fought Marina Moroz. She was Marina Moroz's springboard into the UFC. So some crazy parallels as this one's gone on. But for Karine Silva, I went back and I watched her fight against Siri Rocha. And in that one, she ends up getting the win. She works in her takedowns. And out of a Rocha takedown, she ends up getting a submission win. I've never seen a weirder post fight with a giant, what looked like a KSW trophy or a Ryzen trophy, and then some jacked up, juiced up mascot thing. She looked completely uninterested in it. What I can tell you is, if Karine Silva goes forward and starts to strike, she could do some damage in this one. I worried about her gas tank after her fight against Yan Kihui that she had on Contender Series, but she's one of those fighters at 15 wins, 15 finishes, like Daniel Pineda. If she's able to figure it out, she could beat most fighters in a good
day. I think Souza is the more talented fighter on the outside. I just don't know how many opportunities she's going to get to really be able to tee off with her strikes, because Silva will be that aggressive fighter who will be in your face. I'm not saying she's going to match it with the volume, but it's going to be difficult to really unload with a lot of those kicks if you're moving backwards.
In that Silva fight against Marina Moroz, she starts it off, runs across the cage, throws a Superman punch, and then ends up on top.
I'm talking about wasted volume, Marina Moroz.
Out of the grappling, it's Silva that gets caught in an armbar and submitted in that matchup. So again, 11 first round finishes for Karine Silva, 6 submissions in total. There's a heel hook, rear naked choke, triangle, an armbar, a guillotine, and a Brabo choke. And her last time out, she was able to win by Darce. So a varied attack from somebody like Silva. Although Souza has that black belt in jiu-jitsu, we don't really see it at the forefront of her game. It really is the striking, and it is dynamic until the dying bell. So you look at this one, Matt, in terms of the odds, Silva is favored in the matchup. More than a 2-1 favorite. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Silva.
I was thinking 80 in my head, so I'll say over.
And it is over. 1,360 total votes, 89% Silva, 31% by decision, 59% by submission. For the 11% that have Souza, 58% by decision, and an 18 or 15% by submission. So the fans overwhelmingly have Karine Silva in the matchup.
I've got Silva. I just think the pressure of her is going to be enough to win this fight. Again, I don't even think she has to go out there and get a big knockdown and hit a big blitz. Just the threat of the takedown and the threat of the big blitz should be enough to just stifle some of Souza's attack. Because if Souza is able to get her kicks implemented, throwing combinations, I could see this being a difficult fight for Silva on that back foot. Because we have seen it be difficult for fighters who do rely a lot on those flurries. If they get uncomfortable on the outside, they kind of get stifled and don't really know what to do on the in-betweens. I think Souza could have that game plan, but I do have Silva in the pick.
Yeah, and Souza had those initial kind of falters. She got submitted by Fabulani Mello. She loses to Carnelosi and loses to Diane Cardoso. And the last time I checked, Cardoso just lost a fight over with one against the former champ, Meng Bo, so no shame in that loss whatsoever. But if you do look at it overall, Souza is a very interesting fighter, getting the shot on short notice. I think she's going to bring everything to Karine Silva. And I think Silva's going to win ever so slightly. But this is one of those fights that it could end up shocking a lot of people. I'll put it that way. Both of us going with killer Karine Silva to get the win in the matchup. Somebody from Brazil is going to win.
They will.
Unless it's a draw. I think that's the least hot take I've ever had. Matt, some big-time fights on this card. Kai Kara-France taking on Amir Albazi in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
This weekend was originally to be a shoot-the-box block party, but out is Alan Nascimento. And back on April 28th, it was announced by Nolan King of MMA Junkie that in is Victor Altamirano. And in the matchup, Altamirano is going to be taking on, I assume, the guy that Don Henley was singing about in 1982, Matt. If you give me a chance, I make my living off the evening news. Just give me something, something I can use. People love it when you lose.
I was thinking more about the song from Ace.
They love Dirty Laundry. I don't want to hear you sing, and people might not want to hear me talk. The Dirty Laundry for Tim Elliott, it's out there. You saw it on Twitter. That's all I'm going to say about it. But when you do look at this matchup, Matt, Tim Elliott's one of those guys, 7-10 in the UFC, two different stints, and ultimately, he ends up on the Ultimate Fighter season 24. Kai Kara-France was also on that season. Elliott was a first-round pick. And he ended up in the finals against Demetrius Johnson. Did not win the belt in that fight.
Made a great can of himself.
And since then, Elliott in the UFC, it's been back and forth. I mean, 5-6. His last time out, Khabib Nurmagomedov shouted at the top of his lungs that there was a glove grab against Sagir Ulanbekov. And Tim Elliott, after the fight, said, yeah, I grabbed his glove. But ultimately, that's a win for Tim Elliott. Now, we know the gym situation no longer at Glory MMA and Fitness, but Tim Elliott now out of a big-time gym, Next Generation MMA. You might go, like, Next Gen Liverpool with Paddy Pimblett and Molly McCann? No, Next Generation in One Frisco, Texas with Chris Brennan, whose son is a star with Bellator in Lucas Brennan. So you're going to get that groundwork and the jiu-jitsu work with the Brennans there in Texas. And if you do look at a matchup like this, Matt, I mean, for Tim Elliott, we know how wonky he is with his striking.
I like that he always fights like himself, though, because Tim Elliott is somebody who, again, he's very unorthodox. He is sort of a knockoff Dominic Cruz in the way that he tries to move on the feet. He'll throw that jab out from weird angles and then move off on weird angles, but he always fights like himself. And I mean that to say he's going to go for takedowns, even if you might be the better grappler in some situations. He's going to try to scramble as much as he possibly can, and he's going to be an active fighter until the end of time. And that's what I do like about Tim Elliott in a lot of these matchups. Now, he has fallen on, I'd say, harder times, even though the record does look pretty good in his last five. He doesn't necessarily occupy the same spot in the division that he once did, because we kind of glossed over it. I thought he looked pretty good against DJ, to be fair, and now he lost that fight. He lost a lot of those rounds, but he did hold his own in a lot of those positions, and I did feel like that was one of those, hey, this guy gained a lot of stock, even though he did lose the matchup. Now, for Elliott, it has been a weird run, because he'll have a lot of success in some positions, get into that same position, and then not have some of that success. Look back at that Brandon Royval fight. You were kind of hip to Brandon Royval before I was, but I thought Tim Elliott was going to be able to have one of those classic kind of scramble fest fights, right? We've seen Tim Elliott go out there, shoot the double leg, maybe not get it, but just keep on scrambling and have some success. Brandon Royval shut all of that down, and maybe not every fighter from that point on has been able to have that similar success, but I do think other fighters realize that, okay, if he takes me down, I can get some positions to make it uncomfortable for Elliott, not just let him really outpace me.
Altamirano trains out of a good gym to mix in your grappling at VFIT. Host of Champions. You know him as the ultimate cellist. He was out there before his last fight playing cello as Brendan Fitzgerald's playing the piano. But if you do look at it in this matchup, Altamirano is one of the more interesting guys, because in his amateur career, he fought at LFA 1, and then at LFA 100, he main evented and won the belt. So he was there for that progression. He ends up on Contender Series. It's a really odd fight where he's taking on a guy who ended up in the UFC in Carlos Candelario, lost the first round, the ground and pound, and then he won round 2, round 3. Then he fights Carlos Hernandez in his UFC debut, loses a split decision there. Since then, a one-round fight of the night against Daniel Lacerda type, fight of the night type, because he gets knocked down really early, but then he knocks down Lacerda, nice shot to the body, and then he finishes up with ground and pound, to where Lacerda was just kind of not moving. And then his last time out, he beats Vinicius Salvador in kind of a close fight in both ways. Both guys going for takedowns, both guys working their striking. Altamirano's takedown defense, not a hallmark of his game,
no,
I would say. I mean, it cost him against one championship champ, the Monkey God, Jared Brooks.
He's pretty good.
He got submitted in that one, and then the only other loss, again, Carlos Hernandez, who can box on the outside. But Altamirano can be shifty in his own right. We've seen it in certain fights, the Lacerda fight, where you got to clear the cobwebs, so he's just throwing the kitchen sink at you, kind of reminiscent of a Tim Elliott. And again, Elliott's last time out against Ulanbekov, big overhand left that dropped Ulanbekov round 1. I thought Ulanbekov on the rewatch won round 2 and round 3. A majority saw it that way as well. So for Tim Elliott, it'll be interesting to see if he's the one initiating the takedowns, training out of Next Gen, or if Altamirano is going to have some success with his own Taekwondo background, get some strikes in.
Personally, I think we will see Elliott go for some grappling in this fight. I worry about him on the outside and his ability to absorb a big shot from a guy like Altamirano, because Tim Elliott at one point had like a Forrest Griffin chin, right? Like, you'd hurt him, you'd kind of wobble him, but he'd go for a takedown and he'd kind of forget all about it. We've seen him get stunned in some recent fights, so I do think there's a world out there where Altamirano can threaten enough with some level changes, hurt him with a big shot on the feet, and completely change the complexion of the whole entire fight. But the activity of Elliott's going to be something that Altamirano is really going to have to work around in the matchup.
I mean, Elliott is favored in the fight. Again, he was originally due Alan Nascimento. Elliott's ranked 11th in the UFC's flyweight division as of recording on Sunday, May the 28th. We have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under. I think they're going to be pretty close. I'm going to say over under 62.5% for Tim Elliott.
I'll say over.
And they're over. 1,426 total votes, 69% Elliott, 84% by decision for the 31% that of Altamirano, 74% by decision. I know that Elliott had a knockdown against a top prospect in Ulanbekov his last time out, but Tim Elliott's not like a thunderous puncher. No. We don't see that very often. I'm kind of surprised that Elliott's favored in this matchup by everybody.
I think the wrestling aspect is enough to where Victor Altamirano might struggle to hurt him with a big shot. Elliott's not necessarily in great places to be hit. Now, when he does get hit, he'll kind of get stiff. He won't
springboarded
look
like he did against Mateus Nicolau.
Yeah, exactly. But Altamirano's going to have a difficult time finding the shot. At least that's what I believe. So for me, ever so slightly, I'll pick Tim Elliott. But again, I think enough red flags are up there to where you should just avoid this fight completely, because Altamirano is a big enough puncher and he's a good enough grappler too to where I don't just think Tim Elliott's going to wash him out in a lot of these grappling exchanges. So I'll favor Tim Elliott ever so slightly, but this is a great fight and I'm really looking forward to it, because when you beat Tim Elliott, he's one of those names. What do we say? When you beat Tim Elliott, what happens to you? Great things normally happen to you. So it's a big opportunity for Altamirano.
Do you think Tim Elliott walks out to, like, if you want to play in Texas, you gotta have a fiddle in the band? I don't think he will, but he's now representing Frisco, Texas. The last time Tim Elliott fought Mean, 30-27, 30-27, 30-25, and he was shouting just obscenities
at
Jordan Espinoza. So in that matchup, he was able to get the win. I think Elliott's going to be able to grapple and scramble and have success in the matchup, so I do have Tim Elliott in this fight. But again, I was surprised that he's a favorite, and I was surprised that the fans actually had him. So Matt, both of us scratching our heads, going with Tim Elliott in the matchup. This is one of those fights we really do want to hear from you. Make sure you find us Twitter and Instagram at Fight Night Picks for the matchup and many more on this card, including the next between Jim Miller and Jared Gordon. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The miles and the fights, they keep racking up for A10 Jim Miller. And coming up this weekend, the all-time UFC wins leader and fights leader, he gets an opportunity against the former CFFC man. It is Flash Jared Gordon. 42 days ago, Jared Gordon got flashed. It was a clash of heads against Bobby Green. And then his head clashed off the canvas a couple times as Green landed some more shots. Ultimately, the commentary team, you had Dominic Cruz, you had Paul Felder, and Paul Felder had to say, "I'm calm," and it was really awkward. But Jared Gordon unintentionally got knocked out 48 days ago, and now he's fighting Jim Miller. So this is kind of an oddball fight. If that didn't happen, I would talk about it a different way, but I feel like I need to open the video because it did actually happen, and it's not your run-of-the-mill no contest due to an eye poke.
And this is a difficult fight to come back to because, hey, does Jim Miller hit hard even though he's 39? Sorry, yeah, he still hits pretty hard. Does he have good cardio even though he's almost 40 years old? Yeah, he's still got pretty good cardio. And what Jared Gordon has always been able to do is mix his martial arts, right? I know he has gained a lot with his boxing as his career has progressed, but the thing that got him to the dance was his wrestling. Well, at least a lot of his grappling, I would say, a lot of the ground and pound too. Go back to the Hakran Diaz fight. It's a fight I often bring up because he really out-cardioed him in that matchup, and it kind of set the precursor for what we see now in Jared Gordon's game. If you like to strike, he can take you down. If you like to go for a lot of grappling, he's the guy who can strike and outwork you on the feet. And it is odd because even without that knockout happening, I would still say Jim Miller is the more heavy-handed out of these two. Gordon can put his combinations together and hurt you with shots. I'm not saying he can't by any means, but when Jim Miller plants his feet and puts everything behind one, he still does have pretty good power at this stage of his career. That's why this is a really difficult matchup to predict, because to me, Jared Gordon is very similar to Jim Miller, right? He might not have the height of Jim Miller's jiu-jitsu. Jim Miller at one point was one of the more dangerous guys on the map.
Like a Nick Lentz.
I keep on going back to the Joe Selecki fight that Jim Miller had. There's a good portion of me that feels like Jared Gordon could recreate that gameplay quite effectively.
So if you go back and watch those two fights, Jim Miller, Joe Selecki, Selecki threatens with a lot of submissions. Selecki gets a lot of control time in that fight. Jared Gordon fought Joe Selecki too, and Jared Gordon did about the same thing. And it was one of the more boring rewatches that you could go back and do. Now, for Gordon, it's a win. For Miller, it's a loss. So MMA Math says that Jared Gordon gets the win. But for Jim Miller, it's the fight even before he fights Joe Selecki. The same thing happened at the end of the fight against Vince Pichel. Pichel was the one that was going out there taking down Miller, and Miller couldn't really threaten with a lot of his submissions. Now, for Miller, if you give him an inch, he'll take a mile when it comes to his submissions. Oh, yeah. And you look at his recent wins, well, he didn't even need to utilize that. He knocks out Eric Gonzalez, who hopefully he has a speedy recovery. I saw he just had to have a major surgery over there on Twitter. He knocks out Iron Nicholas Mata. We never thought that would happen. He submits Donald Cerrone. I guess that was somewhat predictable. The hair is coming back. But for Jim Miller, I mean, this is one of those guys, and I haven't done this in a while, but from first under the wire, I've always got Little River Band. Six discs, always here.
Yeah, the guys. Good.
The song Hard Life, it's actually a banger if you go back and listen to it, but Jim Miller's had a hard friggin' life. You don't become the UFC wins leader and fights leader. If you haven't had some really hard fights, he made his debut back in 2008. He wanted to fight UFC 100, UFC 300, which is shortly approaching. And it was unfortunate that they couldn't get Miller on that New Jersey card that was not that long ago in Newark. But overall, in the matchup, Jared Gooden's gotten better with the hands. Jared Gooden, he fought Abubakar Nurmagomedov, was on this card earlier. Jared Gooden's gotten a lot better with his hands. He'll mix in a leg kick every now and again. Jim Miller, as his career has progressed, and especially lately, even in his fight against Alexander Hernandez, a lot of kicks, and he'll try to the three levels. It's more body kick, leg kick, but he will mix it in, and it is a big part. Now, I know Hernandez started to pull away with the numbers, had a lot more volume on the outside, and Miller, at this stage of his career, he bleeds. He bleeds. And if he gets hit, he will bleed. But again, that Gooden knockout, no contest on the mat.
It was no contest.
42 days ago. He was done in the cage 42 days ago. Now he's taking this matchup. That scares the bejeepers out of me.
And it should, you know? Like, if a pitcher gets teed off on for 11 earned runs and like they come back the next day, you're like, hey, is this a great idea?
The last time I talked about anything like this, it was last year when Chris Gutierrez beat Bakary Dana, and then Bakary Dana, a couple months later, fought Kyung Ho Gong. He lost the decision, and he didn't look terrible, but I don't like
And this that. Is where the excitement level comes into play. If it's an exciting fight, Jim Miller's going to win it by knockout. If it's not an exciting fight, I think Jared Gordon's going to lay on top and make this awful to watch. And that's honestly how I do see this fight going. And you don't want to look that much into the Joe Selecki fight. But again, how can Jared Gordon deal with dangerous submission threats off their back? He's heavy on top. He doesn't make a ton of amateur mistakes. He is someone who is an intelligent grappler, and he always has been. Jim Miller's someone who will make you pay for mistakes, like you bring up. You give him an inch, he takes a mile. Be that on the feet or on the mat, because we have seen an uptick in his knockouts, especially as of late. If you do get lackadaisical on the outside, Jim Miller's going to make you pay for it. So it's a really dangerous fight for Gooden, but I do think he has skill sets that Jim Miller at this stage of his career just doesn't necessarily have the counter to.
And you do have Gooden taking this fight on somewhat a short notice. He is replacing Ludwig Klein, the Slovakian striker. So Matt, you look at this one. Gooden is favored to get the win. You have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Gooden.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? It is under. 1,379 total votes. 59% Gooden, 84% by decision. For the 41% that I'm Miller, 40% by decision, 28% by submission, 23% by knockout. Who do you have in the matchup?
You might look at Jim Miller at 39 and Jared Gooden at 34 and think, wow, they are miles apart in age. Jim Miller is shopworn, don't get me wrong. I don't think he's in his prime anymore. That was a very rude way of saying it to begin with. I love Jim Miller fights. There is no disrespect here whatsoever. But Jim Miller's not the guy he once was, right? When he was fighting Cowboy Cerrone in Atlantic City all those years ago. I just think Gooden has also taken a lot of damage throughout his UFC tenure as well. So you can't just look at their ages and think, oh, Jim Miller's just so far in advance that he might be brittle to some degree. Again, I've got to go with my initial pick. I think Gordon's wrestling can get him the win in this fight. And I do think that kind of a game plan can help him largely avoid some of those bigger strikes that you would worry about him on the mat. So I've got Jared Gooden ever so slightly. I think he can make Jim Miller uncomfortable enough on the feet and shoot for enough takedowns to where he just does negate a lot of the strengths Jim Miller has.
Somebody's gonna hop into the comment section way overconfident on one of these two fighters.
Probably.
And they're gonna look like a turkey, and I'm gonna recuse myself because I do have a hard time with it. Gooden recently getting finished. The last time we saw him get into any extended grappling was against Grant Dawson. He got submitted. He fought my guy Leonardo Santos. He ended up beating him up on the feet. Then he goes in there and loses in a 50-50 fight where most people thought that he beat Paddy Pimblett. And then the fight against Bobby Green, he was getting hit on the outside. Some nice counters, though, from Jared Gooden in that matchup. I'll go with Gooden because of the Pichel fight and the fight against Joe Selecki for Jim Miller. But this is a parlay buster if I've ever seen one for somebody out there.
It should be a great fight.
One of the two ways. It should be a great fight. Let us know down below who you have between Gooden and Miller. And now it's come to the time. Caceres is taking on Pineda. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time co-main event coming up this weekend. The Fences. That's where the pit's going to be swinging. Daniel Pineda looking to stamp his place in the rankings of the top 15 in the UFC's featherweight division, taking on the 15th ranked featherweight Bruce Leroy, Alex Caceres, and Alex Caceres over his last 7 fights has been absolutely amazing. This is a guy that came into the Ultimate Fighter Season 12, and I know Caceres is actually 3 years younger than Daniel Pineda. He made his UFC debut a year earlier than Pineda, who had his own run back in the 2012 region. Now, Pineda's wasn't all that great. He had to go rework his craft on the regional scene. He ends up in the PFL on Season 2, was supposed to fight for the $1 million against the party, Lance Palmer, elevated levels of testosterone, ended up kicking him out of that. But in one night, he finished Junior Bacon Cheeseburger, Jeremy Kennedy, and Mavlid Khabibulaev, who doesn't have a loss on his record, by finish in each of those first rounds. Daniel Pineda has finished every single one of his 28 wow. professional wins. It's absolutely insane. And after a long time away from his fight against Andre Feely, where he got hit at distance, a guy who I always think, Andre Feely, Alex Caceres, same guy, really tall. They prod from the outside, really same guy. But when you look at it for Pineda, that eye poke was a game changer. He had injuries that took him away from that fight into his fight against Tucker Lutz. And as a giant underdog against Tucker Lutz, I mean, we're talking the heavy overhands. We're talking about his wrestling and his submission abilities against Lutz. He was able to get a second round finish win there. The Herbert Burns win that he had to make his UFC debut was very impressive. And then, of course, he has the loss to Cub Swanson, where first half of the first round, kid's burning hot, as Dana White would probably say, or at least a mixture of Dana White and myself. But then as the first round waned, Pineda got tired, and then in the second round, Swanson was able to take over. So in this matchup, Matt, Alex Caceres, the thing that scares me about him is, going back on the rewatch, his knockdown ratio in the UFC. 5-4, 5 against, and all 5 against are in the first round.
I'm a lot more worried about Alex Caceres getting held down on the mat, personally, because Caceres is an odd fighter. He's extremely well-rounded, but he will have kind of lapses in judgment every now and then, even in fights where he's winning. And it has been odd, because like you say, Caceres reminds me a lot of the career of Angela Hill. And I only say it for this reason. Angela Hill, we've seen every single one of her fights in the professional stage, right? Like, she basically entered in the UFC, went to Invicta, came right back to the UFC. Caceres did have some fights before he went into the Ultimate Fighter, but for the most part, we have seen the majority of his progression throughout the UFC, and let's just be honest, it took him a while to figure it out. He always had a high level skill set. He made a bet at a show against Yair Rodriguez years back, and it was a close fight of the night. Decision. Exactly. A split fight of the night against a guy who is now going to fight for the title. So it shows you where Alex Caceres once was in the division, but his skill set never really evolved. Guys could get on the inside, make him uncomfortable, so okay, now he's not winning everything on the feet. Then it was guys could take him down and they could hold him down. Well, now he's not winning everything on the mat. The thing about Caceres, though, that I do like is his stick-to-itiveness, I would say, at this stage of his career. Like, even when he gets in bad positions now, he's not just going to waste time. And then, like, the Crow Gracie fight is a bad loss for Alex Caceres because he just kind of stopped fighting in that one position. Crow Gracie got him in and he choked him out. But I would say that was when he really did step up and become a significantly better fighter.
And, I mean, I talk about the first round knockdowns and some of them are finishes. He did have one way back against Edwin Figueroa. That was one that happened to be a first round knockdown. Francisco Rivera hits him with the left hook, being an orthodox fighter, drops him, and there were 5 shots, and there was Caceres hitting the mat, and we saw it out of Caceres' last time out, reversed the fortune. Now, all of a sudden, I'm 1-3 in first-round fights. He got one done against Julian Arosa, so a giant win there. Both of these guys, they do have a common opponent, Makan Smerzier, and Smerzier was able to beat Caceres. But Daniel Pineda in his first UFC run, that was actually his lone win. So it is an interesting fight. We do look at it for both of these guys. For Pineda, it's a lot of those big actions, blitz forward, throw a lot of, you know, wonky hooks, and then he's able to close the distance up against the fence. That's a hard word.
Cage.
And then get the takedown and then try and implement his jiu-jitsu with Caceres. Sometimes it works out great for him in some of those compromised positions, you would think. Sometimes it ends up like the Jason Knight fight where we're goofing around on the ground and then he ends up getting finished. So I'm eager to see this fight because it is a tricky one. Again, Pineda, 37. All of these finish wins, but if it goes south, it goes really south. So we
threw. And Caceres isn't a guy who's going to throw the kitchen sink at you round one and then not be there for round 2, 3. It could be a case where, hey, Pineda's having a lot of early success, kind of win the battle but lose the war type deal. Because if he's not able to get Caceres out of there and you do see him working at a very high pace, Caceres has fought 5 round fights and can fight at a high rate.
The two examples of that, his fight against Sungmoo Choi, where he gets hurt and dropped, but then he rallies back and gets a submission win, and his fight against a guy who had 1 fight in the UFC and and it's so unfortunate that we didn't get to see any more, Guan Wong. And in that fight, Guan lands that crazy knockout blow or knockdown blow with 11 seconds left in the first round. He's hitting Caceres. Then Caceres gets up to referee Steve Percival. Baby deer legs. Wong's celebrating like he won the fight because it looked like he did. And then for some stretch, Caceres is able to go out there to the second round. Eddie Cha in the corner for that one. Yeah. And Caceres wins the second and the third. It's a split decision, it was a split decision win for Guan Wong, but a crazy fight nonetheless. So we threw this one out there to you over on YouTube in the community tab. You guys voted on it. 77% going with Caceres. Air Dog saying, Bruce... Jumpins. Bruce Leroy looked impressive against Juicy J. Leroy all day. And Artem MMA saying Caceres round 3 finish over gassed out Pineda. Matt, Caceres is favorite in the matchup. Who do you have?
I like him for his lasting ability. Again, if Pineda gets that top position and can do a lot of work with it, really damage with his ground and pound, I could see him getting the win via TKO. Maybe even submission if Caceres does give up the back. But if he doesn't get that, and if Caceres can weather that initial storm, I do favor him in round 2 and round 3. So for those reasons, I do find myself picking the old Bruce Leroy.
Give me Daniel Pineda in the matchup. I got fooled in the Tucker Lutz fight. I gave out all those kind of buzzword red flags. This is why you should pick Daniel Pineda, but I'm going with Tucker Lutz. For me with Pineda, the lasting ability in that second round, the cardio didn't look like it waned, even though he threw the big shots in the first round. I do like Pineda to catch Caceres at some point in this matchup, because as I said, Caceres gets hit and he gets hit clean in the first round of his matchup. So I'm going with Daniel Pineda in the fight. You get Alex Caceres. Continue to let us know who you do have. Okay. The fan vote is quite split on this matchup. In the main event coming up at 125, Kai Kara-France taking on Amir Al-Bazi. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Back after a week away with Fight Night Picks, as always, one half your host to do it, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And in the marquee, the first non-title flyweight fight since 2017 when Sergio Pettis fought Brandon Moreno. We have Don't Blink Kai Kara-France, and he's going to be matching up with the Prince Amir Al-Bazi. And I mean, if you look at this fight, both guys, tons of success in the UFC. Kai Kara-France, if we get down to dirty, he's coming off a flyweight interim championship fight in his rematch with Brandon Moreno. Looked really good in the first round, really good in the second round. One judge had it 2018 for Kara-France. One judge had it 2018 Moreno. The other one was split. It was too hot. It was too cold. It was just right. I'll tell you what was just right. That kick to the body from Brandon Moreno in the third round. So ultimately, Kai Kara-France, he was due a fight earlier on this year. That one did not materialize against Alex Perez. So where he was training for a wrestler in that matchup, now he gets a great grappler in Amir Al-Bazi. And we do say this, a clash of styles. Al-Bazi, I mean, he started at London Shoe Fighters. Then he goes over to Extreme Couture. You get to see his full breadth of boxing his last time out.
Yeah, he's at zero on the feet.
Though he was ranked 8th. Against the UFC debuting Alessandro Costa in that matchup. Dropped him in the second round. Dropped him in the third round with different shots in those two. They vary. But Amir Al-Bazi, a great jab. That shovel right that he has is really something to watch out for. You got to watch for the uppercuts from the Prince. But when it does come down to his ground game, I know he was a world champ when it came to his jiu-jitsu at the blue belt category. He was a Swedish champ multiple times over. Amir Al-Bazi is one of those guys you have to look out for. And finally, he gets a really stiff test in a guy like Kai Kara-France.
It's the big step up in competition that he does need. Not just the step up rankings-wise. Kai Kara-France is a pretty big name in the division, right? Like, he's a guy who's been there, done that, fought Brandon Moreno twice, fought Cody Garbrandt in a huge fight on a pay-per-view. Like, Kai represents a big name in the division that Amir Al-Bazi desperately needs. Because if he is able to get over Kai, not necessarily the fact that he absorbs all of his fans or the Garbrandt win, but it's going to give him a lot more notoriety than he has ever had before. Because for Al-Bazi, the skills have been there, and he's definitely been able to grow in the striking. The wrestling was so outrageously dominant for a stretch. Like, Amir Al-Bazi's strength is probably his X factor. When he gets a hold of guys, when he gets the hands clasped around them, there's not really any getting out out of that one position. Now, I will be interested to see how the movement of Kara France does stifle some of those entries, because Kasegawa, who is comfortable with moving on the outside, can throw with power off the back foot, but when he's moving forward, there's not a lot of guys in the flyweight division who can deal with it. I'm glad to bring up the Moreno fights because they're weird. Kai wins a lot of the minutes in those fights. Doesn't win the big moments, but he wins a lot of minutes. Even go back and watch their first fight. He's using the boxing very well. He's landing steady shots on Moreno, but Moreno would land a big hook. He'd land a big head kick that would kind of revert a lot of that volume back into Moreno's favor. So for Kai, he's been able to get to the top of the division, but never quite break through. So this is still a really important fight for him too, because if he loses to Albazi, not that to us, not that to anyone who really knows how good Albazi is, that's that big of a loss. But for Kai, he's had that many bites at the top of the division. If he loses this, he might almost get reverted down to like a Derek Brunson position, to where it's like, okay, you're still a great fighter, but you're really just subjected to fighting a lot of these prospects on their way up. And I do think Kai Kara France is a guy who, if he is able to win another two or three fights, I'm not saying he's going to fight a third time against Moreno. That's hard to do with him losing the first two. But could he have a competitive fight with a Pantoja? Could he go out there with a Manel Kopp and have a good fight? Like, I think those are all fights that a lot of fans want to see if he is able to get past Amir Albazi.
And for Kai Kara France, it's interesting because, again, we talk about knockdown differential. He's been in the UFC for a time. I mean, he's 7-3 so far. But 6-4 is the knockdown ratio.
His fights are wild.
Even in his UFC debut, it's on that big fight card. Shady S taking on Tai Tuivasa. He's taking on Elias Garcia, grappler. And in that one, Garcia lands an overhand left that drops Kai Kara France. He's back up to his feet. It was an interesting one because I talked about Muin Gafurov, who's also on this card. He threatens with a heel hook to get back up. But Kara France is one of those guys. He can threaten with a heel hook. He can threaten with a couple of different things, or at least he'll grab your ankle. And
he's
then
more active than you would assume a primary grappler would be.
He tries to pop his way back up. A primary striker, I think you meant.
Sorry, but yeah, primary striker.
When you look at a guy like Kai Kara France, he too excels in a lot of the scrambles. Now, is that the best place to get into against a guy like Amir Albazi, whose lone loss comes to Shorty Torres? Probably not. And the sad thing, I guess, for Amir Albazi is since he debuted in 2020 against Malcolm Gordon, that was both of their debuts, he's only had the four fights total. So he beats Gordon, he beats Yaga Shumagulov, he beats Francisco Figueiredo, first round submission, and he beats Alessandro Costa his last time out.
Such a big step up.
And when you do look at it for Albazi, again, the grappling is a big thing because once he takes you down, he's not necessarily like a guy like a Khabib Nurmagomedov. If you get up, it's chaining the takedown back. Most guys don't get back up. Like, he holds you down. He's able to keep position. His top pressure is really good. And if it gets back standing, he's not a squared up grappler when it does come to his strikes. He does have a really good leg kick. He will mix in his boxing. He's got a nice left hook to the body. Does Albazi, but he will pump that jab out there once, twice to keep you thinking. It's obviously the movement on the outside of a guy like Kai Kara France, where he can pepper you, and he can do it for three rounds. I'm sure he can do it for five. Yeah. I'll be interested to see if Albazi can do a little bit of the same in a fight like this. And again, Kai Kara France, he came into the Ultimate Fighter season 24 like Tim Elliott. Tim Elliott was the number one overall pick. Kai Kara France, 8th overall pick.
Pretty good value on that.
8th round pick, I guess, by Henry Cejudo on that one. Henry Cejudo and Joseph Benavidez, the coaches, they got cocked because the winner got to fight the actual champ, and those two were title challengers.
Oh, that's the term
former title challengers. So that was a weird season there.
I have a really hard time with this fight because I think if it was three rounds, I'd say Amir Albazi without a doubt in my mind. Maybe not without a doubt in my mind, but you get the idea. If he's able to control two of the rounds with his wrestling, it's pretty difficult for Kai to just make up the difference in that third round. But the movement and the just... he's good at getting back up to his feet, guys. Like, Kai Kara France isn't a black belt. He's not a Division I wrestler. He is very much a kickboxer. But he is squirrely on the mat. And there might be a world where I think, okay, he can scramble a little bit, get back up to his feet, land power shots. There's another world where Amir Albazi gets that first takedown and holds him down, and we just never really see Kai get his striking going in the first place.
And we have seen guys have success against Kai Kara France with their grappling. Brandon Royval, the spinning elbow into the illegal knee. Rogerio Bontorin, and you did see Kara France get dropped in the second round against Brandon Royval. That was a two-round fight of the night. They're rare, but at flyweight, they happen. Matt, again, we have a look at your poll over there in the YouTube community tab. We threw it out there to you. 62% of you have Kai Kara France to get the win in the matchup. So ultimately, the hesitance, and I'm really tricky on this one, kind of going back and watching the tape study, I found myself not looking at the bad things and only looking at the good things. But when you're trying to make a pick on this one, who have you got?
I'm going to ever so slightly say Amir Albazi. I think his ability to threaten with the submission will be enough to where I don't worry about him having to go out there and win every single round, because that's initially what I had said. If this was a 3-round fight, again, Albazi's wrestling should be good enough to control 7.5 minutes, right? In a 15-minute fight, that's all you really have to do to be able to win it. But in 25 minutes, if Kai is able to spring back up to his feet, win, you know, the later half of the fight, because he does have great volume, and we've seen it in 3-round fights, his volume doesn't drop from round 1 to round 3. He is a guy who will stay competitive, will gain as the fight goes on, and he is a guy who, when he senses his opponent start to slow down, that's when he really puts his foot on the gas and picks up the pressure. So again, I feel like I'm painting a picture for Kai Kara-France, but I do think the wrestling of Albazi is going to be able to stifle the timing enough to where Kai Kara-France won't get comfortable with his bigger power strikes to begin with.
There's going to be a lot of people that are going to whine in the comments this week, give me Kai Kara-France in the matchup. And the reason why I like him is he circles away. You watch the guys that are fighting Amir Albazi. What do? They fight in a straight line. You look at what Costa was doing. You look at what Zhumagulov was doing. Gordon struggled on the mat, and he also had that win over Francisco Figueiredo, who fights like an old-timey boxer, but his takedown defense just can't cash those checks. Albazi was able to get it done on the mat. I like the speed out of a guy like Kai Kara-France. If you can show that against Moreno before he ends up getting kicked to the gut, that really does something for me. But then Kara-France, two camps in a row, Perez, the wrestler, and Amir Albazi, I think that's going to play out for Kai Kara-France. So split on the pick in the matchup. I'm going with, don't blink, Kai Kara-France to get the win. Matt going with the Prince, Amir Albazi to get it done. It has been an interesting year with Fight Night picks. A couple of weeks between these cards. We had the video out there, if you haven't checked it out, about some of the most skilled fighters that we've seen in the UFC, but those results, they were the worst. So make sure you check that one out here on the channel. If you want to throw out some ideas for that series called Parry and Counter, please do. We have a show called Kicks 2 hours before the prelims. If anything changed throughout the week, if anything big happened on weigh-in day on Friday, we get the opportunity to break it down and dissect it 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday. So make sure you check out that show. Toss a like on your way out if you haven't already. Keep up the good work down there in the comments section. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it.